Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'd like to welcome you to the City Council meeting for the City of Cedar Hills. Today is Tuesday, May the 2nd, 2017, and I have 7 p.m. I'd like to call our meeting to order. Tonight's pledge will be given by the mayor, and the invocation will be given by Councilmember Reese. So, I thought we did pledge second, but I could be wrong. Will the audience please rise?
Please repeat after me.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
The audience may be seated.
Heavenly Father, we are grateful for this opportunity we have to meet together as representatives of this wonderful city. We are grateful for so many who give their time and talents to make this a wonderful place to live. We ask you to bless us this evening as we are discussing the business of the city, that we can do so in a manner that is pleasing unto thee, and that we will make decisions in the best interests of our residents. And these things we pray for in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen. Amen.
Thank you very much. We next have to approve the meeting's agenda. I have asked Councilmember Bailey to make an adjustment in order to accommodate Kevin Oakleberry from DEQ. So, Mr. Bailey.
I move that we move up discussion item 18 in front of number 8.
Right. I have a motion to amend the agenda, moving item number 18 above number 8.
I can second that.
And he has made a motion to approve that. Is there a second?
I second it.
Oh, you did. I'm sorry. I didn't hear that. Motion has been seconded. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion was unanimous. Thank you very much. Moving on to public comments. I did not see that anyone had signed up, and so we will close that part of our meeting and move to a public hearing. So we have a public hearing scheduled tonight relating to the amendments for the fiscal year FY17 budget. That's July 1st of 2016 to June 30th of 2017. Is there anyone here that has come to speak on the budget and would like to do so during the public hearing? No? Close that part of our meeting and move on to the consent agenda. So it looks as if we have minutes from just one meeting, and that is the March 21st, 2017 work session and city council meeting. Someone like to make a motion on the consent agenda? I will take that.
I move to approve the consent agenda.
Okay, I have a motion to accept. Is there a second?
Second.
Seconded by Mrs. Reese. All those in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Motion was unanimous. Thank you very much. Moving on to city reports and business, starting from my left, Mr. Goodwin, go ahead.
We have recreation registration open for the following classes and programs. We have youth computer coding class, coaches pitch baseball, t-ball, a bowling league with Jack and Jill Lanes, Lego summer camp, junior golf clinics, beginner and intermediate, and a women's golf clinic. The recreation department is going to be holding a 3-on-3 soccer tournament and pickleball tournament as part of the family festival this year, and registration is open for both of those events. We also wanted to give a big thank you to all those who came and participated in our days of service. There's multiple days that we required people out there on the roundabout at 4600 and Cedar Hills Drive. You'll notice that there's a new landscaping there. We had a great turnout on the last Saturday. I'd say about 30 people showed up. Thank you for the mayor and the council members for coming. It looks great. The project went well. We're really excited about the improvements there. And the recreation has been working with Boyd and Robin from the Parks and Rec or the Parks and Trails Committee to find a new place to put our recreation banners. There's been some discussion about not wanting, in light of the new improvements on that roundabout, not having the roundabout have that host that sign that we've traditionally put there, and we're looking at other options of where we can put that. Bay Hill Park is nearing substantial completion, and staff's going to begin the process of selecting some playground equipment and bringing that to the Parks and Trails Committee and having them make a recommendation to the council, which will ultimately approve the funding for. And then the golf course maintenance building is being framed, and we're looking forward to moving in, and we want to give a thank you to our golf employees who have been very patient through that process. Thank you.
Thank you. Mrs. Reese.
Family Festival is this month, and we need a lot of volunteers, so please, please, please sign up and tell everybody you know to please sign up. It's May 30th.
Oh, yeah. Is it June?
No. Well, it starts on May 30th, so right. It's, yeah. But we need a lot of volunteers.
I have signed up. Okay. Mr. Geddes?
Nothing to report.
Thank you. Regarding Lone Peak Public Safety, we did have a meeting last week. We did spend the majority of our time in exec session. If you're curious, then come talk to me. Mr. Geddes, I'll bring you up to speed on what happened. I don't think we've had a finance committee meeting, but we do have Mr. Lowe here tonight, who's going to talk about budget amendments and also a tentative fiscal year budget for FY18. So that is it.
I don't have anything to report.
Thank you, Mr. Bailey. Mr. Zappala.
I just add to what Chandler said about our service day. It was a really fantastic success. We had quite a lot of residents out there. I was really pleased to see their participation from residents. It looks great. Really excited for what we've done.
Thank you. Mr. Crawley.
Yeah, we had a meeting with the Planning Commission, and we discussed amending our code a little bit to not require that a bed and breakfast or the reception center being held in someone's house be a historic place. And we were striking that from the code, or it was recommended that be struck from the code. I assume that's going to come to City Council, Chandler?
Yeah, what we did was in our current bed and breakfast code that was in the city code, there's a provision that any bed and breakfast located within the city had to be designated as a historic structure by the state and national registries. The only problem is we don't have a single building that's a historic structure, so we removed that provision.
Now, does that have to come to City Council?
Yeah, that the approval of that code change will come to the City Council.
Probably next time, huh?
Yeah.
Okay, that's all I have.
Thank you very much. Okay, that is our city reports and business. We have moved item number 8, which is a discussion on the American Fork Canyon water and soil testing. We have Kevin Oakleberry. Did I say your name right?
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much, Kevin. And so on our city's website, we have the results of our water, soil, sediment tests. They're all there. We are going to share them on the city's Facebook page as well. And so we'll have it all out there. We invited Kevin with DEQ to be with us so that we can have a discussion about our results, and you should have the results in front of you, and how to interpret them, because none of us are water engineers. I think Kevin probably is a water engineer, or he's trained in that area. And so, Kevin, if you want to step up to the mic and maybe tilt it up a little bit.
Yeah, they don't make these for me, do they?
Thank you.
Is that close enough? I appreciate the opportunity to come here and discuss with the council, Mayor. Thank you very much for inviting me. I have some business cards here. If you have any questions afterwards, I have an answer. If you run out, I have more in the car. In regards to the sampling that was done by Cedar Hills, part of it was soil samples and then also water samples from some of the waterways. Just by way of review, everyone's familiar with what happened last fall. On August 22nd, there was a large release of sediment from the Kibble Fork Reservoir. This caused significant ecological damage, killed off most of the fish in a 2-mile stretch of river, released a large amount of sediment that, based on a 2010 survey of the lake, contained large amounts or elevated amounts of heavy metals. This, of course, is a legacy of upstream mining up on the North Fork of the American Fork River. And so as part of that, DEQ has been monitoring the situation. They've been working to address and enforce the Utah Water Quality Act on the responsible party. And the public comment period, public comment period for the settlement agreement with the district was finalized yesterday. And then it will be brought up to review before the State Water Quality Board when they finally to get their final approval before it can take effect. As far as the results of Cedar Hills, and Mr. Mogg is here, he'll be able to help me if I've got anything wrong. Four sediment samples, sediment or soil samples, were taken from locations on the Cedar Hill Golf Course, Mesquite Park, and the bed of, is that the canal bed of Heritage Park, is that correct?
There was sediment, yes, Heritage.
Okay, so
Park,
it's...
soil.
Mesquite was soil, and then Heritage Park was, as I understand, was sediment from the bed of the canal and the park.
Yeah.
It goes to the park.
Sure.
Okay. And then there were three water samples taken, one from the pond at Cedar Hills Golf Course, and then there was another pond at the golf club. I'm not exactly sure where pond 12 is. It's that
pond 12 is up on the next to Canyon Road, and
okay.
Pond 10 is down at the mouth
pond
of the canyon.
Pond 10 at the mouth of the canyon. And then the Heritage Park irrigation ditch, I guess at Heritage Park again. And looking at these samples, basically, there is nothing here which is elevated above the screening levels or standards that we use. Now, a bit of explanation about the standards that Division of Water Quality has been using since the start of the event. There are three standards that we look at as far as water. We look at water as far as it relates to safety or for recreational water use. This would be, can children play in the stream for 3 hours without any excessive risk of exposure to excessive amounts of metals? There's also a value for aquatic wildlife. Is it within the levels that would be considered to be acceptable for fish and invertebrate life in the stream? And then finally, there's a value that we use for water, or for irrigation water. Can this water be used as livestock watering, irrigation for crops, for agriculture use in general? And then for sediment samples, soil samples and sediment samples, we screen for health-based comparison for recreational sediment, or recreational use of the canal or waterway, for example. Once again, could children play in this stuff for 2 or 3 hours without any excessive risk? And then there's also a value for aquatic wildlife. Is this excessive in terms of aquatic wildlife, fish, macroinvertebrates, amphibians, other animals that may use the stream itself? In summary, the numbers that you have, the results of the three water samples and the four sediment samples, soil samples, are all below these screening levels. If you look on that last page on the handout there, where they've been tabulated, you'll see at the top it says water test results. And you see the water, recreational water screening values, and then in parentheses it says total metals. Total metal samples are those water samples. We just take the water and then you run the entire sample. You run the sample as is. That the total metals includes everything in the water column, including sediment that has been suspended, colloidal sediments, dissolved metals, things like that. So it reflects everything that's in the water. The irrigation and livestock water screening values are dissolved metal standards. Dissolved metals are obtained by taking that same sample and running it through a 45 or 0.45 micron filter, similar to the ones a lot of people use for hiking and camping, which filters out all the suspended sediments, all the colloidal sediments, and leaves only those metals that are actually dissolved. And the dissolved metal standard is actually a stricter standard than the recreational standard. If you'll note there, you have the values in milligram per liter. For example, for arsenic, you can have up to 7.9 milligram per liter, whereas for dissolved metals, you can have no more than 2. Looking down at the results of your three water samples, they're well below both of those standards. And that's pretty consistent all the way across for all of the metals. None of your water samples exceed either the total metal sample or total recreational standard for the dissolved metal standard, the irrigation, livestock, agricultural use standard. Not included in this is the aquatic wildlife, because these canals are not considered to be aquatic wildlife habitat. They go dry at the end of the year, so they're not considered to be a trout stream, so we wouldn't use that standard in this case. And feel free to interrupt me if you have any questions, any concerns. The second group of results, you have soil sediment test results. You have the sediment values for recreation, and this is once again based on, can people expose themselves through recreational activities, wading in the mud, playing in the mud for a certain amount of time without any excessive risk. And if you look there, we have the standards there at the top. For example, arsenic, the standard is 753 milligram per kilogram, which is equivalent to part per million. If you look there below, all of your samples from the four locations, two at Cedar Hills Golf Club, one at Mesquite Park, one at Heritage Park, are all well below that standard. Same with lead. You have a standard of 400 part per million, milligram per kilogram. All of those numbers are well below the standard for lead for recreational use. And then if you're wondering how these numbers compare to other sampling locations, if you look on the page before that last page, you'll see some bar graphs that I worked on. These are the four main metals of concern in terms of the tip of fork discharge. The levels of arsenic, lead, cadmium, and zinc were all elevated above one or more of the standards, primarily the aquatic wildlife standard for sediment. So we use those as kind of markers to see if there's any elevated amounts, because these are the four ones that we would consider to be a problem. And if you look there, for example, average lead content of soils and sediment, you look on that graph, you see on the far left, you see what's called upstream. This is the average content of the sediment in the samples that we collected last August up above Tibble Fork Dam. And that has a value of 51.0 parts per million, 51.0 milligram per kilogram. And then American Fork City in December collected samples from the three city parks listed there, Art Dye, Fox Hollow Golf Course, Rotary Park. Those are all within the same range. You have here the Golf Course Pond, Heritage Park, and Mesquite Park are down in the 20s. The Golf Course Canal number 10 is slightly elevated at 140, but once again, that's well below the recreational standard of 400. And then on the far right, you see two values. Number one is what's called pre-event. There was sediment left over from early 2016 that the irrigation district tested. This is stuff that came down before the Tibble Fork discharge, and it was removed from the irrigation pond at the mouth of the canyon in early 2016. And if you look there, the values are very close. Well, they're within the range of what we saw upstream at 71.5. And then there on the far right, you see the value for the reservoir. This is the value, the average value of the six core samples that were collected from the bottom of Tibble Fork Reservoir in August of 2010. And if you'll note there, it's very high. 351.7 is the average value. Two of the six values actually exceeded the standard there. So you can obviously see that the values.
Is the standard at 400? Is that line what that is?
Yes, that line represents the RSL value. The RSL value is the residential screening level.
Right.
This was used as the level for lead. On the other graphs, the screening level was either way too high. On the arsenic graph, you'll note there it's way down near the bottom, but that's because pretty much everywhere in Utah is going to be above that. Utah has a high background of arsenic, very natural. If you'll note, the range that you're getting with arsenic is in between 6 to 10 or 6 to 16. That's considered to be normal for this area. And of course, in the reservoir, you've got 32.3 parts per million, so that's obviously elevated. Same thing with zinc. Zinc is, you have the golf course number 10 sample, which is elevated above what's upstream, but it's definitely below the reservoir level, and it's well below the screening level that we would use for recreational. Screening level for zinc is 49,628 milligram per kilogram, so it's
way off the chart, essentially.
Yeah, that's why there wasn't a line on the zinc.
Okay, that makes sense.
Same thing with the cadmium. If you'll note there's no line on the cadmium. Cadmium has a level of 87 milligram per kilogram, and obviously the highest value you've got there is from the reservoir of 5.8. So, once again, the only caveat that I have to say is that I'm not the official expert at DEQ on these types of numbers, but based on this data, it appears that these samples that were collected in Cedar Hills are within what we would expect as natural variation or background levels, or if they are elevated, they are well below what is considered to be excessive for recreational use of the sediment or soil.
So, Kevin, I just do have one question, which is that the samples taken from the reservoir back in August of 2010.
Yes.
Is that the last year for which you have solid data, or is there a reason why we're 7 years back for baseline?
I do not believe there is any other data from the reservoir bed prior to the discharge.
That's what I thought.
That was actually done, performed by a contractor for a Natural Resources Conservation Service in preparation for the Tibble Fork project. It was part of a bathymetric survey of the reservoir to get an idea of how much sediment there was. It's part of the environmental assessment, so I don't believe anyone else took any data or any other samples from the bottom of the reservoir between now and then.
Thank you. Council, do you have any questions for Mr. Oakenberry?
I do. So I'm sure you are as familiar as we are with, there's a group called Protect and Preserve, and they have stated on multiple occasions that they have also done samples and that their samples are coming back stating that they are exceeding recreational use. And I know there's been some discussion back and forth on the validity of their samples, and so I was just wondering if you could explain to us where the issue lies there.
There are, well, the two samples that you're talking about, first off, there have been approximately 50 to 60 samples of sediment, river sediment, collected from either the reservoir or the river or the irrigation system downstream by six different entities: American Fork City, Cedar Hills, National Park Service, Division of Water Quality, the contractor, and then Protect and Preserve American Fork Canyon. The two samples that were collected on the 22nd of August, we have the data from those samples. We have extensively reviewed those samples, extensively analyzed, and we have come to the conclusion that we do not feel those samples are representative of the actual impact on the American Fork River ecosystem. And if they are valid, represent a temporary transient condition in the river that existed only at the time the samples were taken. None of these other entities that have collected samples since then have been able to replicate those samples, those results. All the other, for example, the stuff that was found in the reservoir beforehand for lead ranged 140 parts per million to 660 parts per million. Virtually everyone else who is the Park Service, our samples, the consultant hired by the irrigation district, virtually everyone else has found their samples in that range. These two samples are anywhere from 3 to 10 times higher than that. And a statistical analysis that we have performed suggests that that's not possible based on the composition of the samples and how their results are graphing compared to the other samples. Now, having said all that, anything's possible, but it's statistically unlikely that those samples are representative of what has happened in the river.
So how does that come about then? If it's statistically improbable, it's just an outlier, and it, the area where they took had an unusually high.
There are several factors. There's actually five discrepancies that we have noted, and I don't want to get into too deep get too much into the weeds on the details, but for one, the samples were actually collected in a different manner than everybody else's sediment samples. As I said before, their results fall outside of what a statistical regression line would predict, given the amount of sediment in the water and the metals values. They're significantly higher. The third point is that it's almost 10 times higher than what was known to be in the reservoir beforehand. No one has seen levels like that either before or since. The fourth reason is no one has been able to replicate those samples. As I said before, virtually everyone else who has collected sediment samples from the river and from the irrigation ponds and upstream has found levels that are within the same range, within the range that would be predicted by the amount of metals in the sediment from the 2010 survey. And then finally, the samples themselves contain far more aluminum and iron than what would be expected to be found in the American Fork River drainage. The main sample that has 5,300 parts per million lead is 19% aluminum and 35% iron, which is, it's not considered to be likely or very likely, given the fact that this is randomly sorted reservoir sediment that's being shot down the river and mixed as it's going. Especially since the fact that that sample didn't have any calcium or magnesium analyzed, and normally calcium and magnesium are found in concentrations at least as equal to or four times higher than iron. So putting it in perspective, the sample that has 5,300 parts per million lead is 54% iron or aluminum. If you apply the normal proportions of calcium and magnesium that you would expect to find in the sediment to that sample, you would find a sample that had 250% calcium, aluminum, magnesium, and lead, or iron, excuse me.
So,
and that's simply, that's a practical impossibility.
So do you recall how those two samples in question were taken and how that was different from how everyone else's samples were taken?
My understanding is that they were taken as water samples from the water column. So the person who took the samples, dipped the container in, collected the sample from the water as it was flowing down the river.
Okay.
And then to us, that would be a total metals water sample, and we would have it analyzed as a water sample. Instead, they had it analyzed as a sediment sample, which they had the lab isolate the sediments from the water and then run it as if it were a sediment sample. Our sediment samples we collect from the bottom of the river, from sediments that have accumulated, not from the water column. Okay. So that's where the discrepancy between the sediment collection methods. And once again, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's invalid. It just means that there's a difference. There's a potential for a discrepancy there.
So are there any conclusions that an expert could draw from these two samples in question as in comparison to all the other samples?
Well, as I have listed, there's five conclusions that we've drawn from them. And because of this, we feel once again that if these samples are valid, they represent a temporary condition in the river that does not exist, and no one else has been able to replicate, no one else has been able to find. The Park Service is the only entity that took a sample on the 22nd of August during the main discharge. DEQ, or the Division of Water Quality in particular was not notified until the 23rd, the morning of the 23rd. So we didn't get up here until it had been going on for about 24 hours. The Park Service's sample correlates very well with our samples,
okay,
but it's nowhere close to these other two samples. And so once again, we can't dismiss them as being nothing. They may be valid, but we simply do not believe that they are representative of what actually happened in the river.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yes.
When you're taking a sample, what's the method of a sediment sample, for instance? What's the method of getting that sample? Do you go down a certain amount of inches, or do you skim off the top? How do you
In general, the sediment samples are collected. You take the top 3 inches of recently deposited sediments. The general practice is to take 3 different locations in the same sampling area, mix them together in a bowl, and then take a certain amount. It's 4 ounces roughly. That's the size of the container. Place it in the container and then take it to the lab.
So my thoughts with that is 3 inches probably takes a long time to accumulate, whereas if you took just what it accumulated, say, in that 24-hour period, you might get a lot higher concentrations.
Well, yes, that is possible. And we considered that as well, and we went back to how much was in the reservoir before all this started. And so you had the core samples, which represent the best data that we have from the reservoir. And for example, with lead, the core samples, none of them were higher than 660 parts per million, whereas these two samples are at 5,300 parts per million, and I believe 1,530 parts per million.
What do you think? They were in the same 3 inches in the reservoir when they took those core samples?
Well, the reservoir, they did a statistical analysis. They took varying levels of some of them were shallow samples, some were deeper sediments.
Can you tell me how shallow or how deep they could?
I think one of the samples was, I think, like the first 2 inches. One of them went down to 18 inches. They tried to get a variation of, so that they'd be able to statistically represent what the levels throughout the sediment was, what the average column sediment would be.
Any other questions from the council?
Just one. I know we lost all the wildlife, at least the fish in there. I used to fish there. Mm-hmm. But was that the event? Was it the sediment that killed the fish, or was it the high levels of?
It was the according to the Division of Wildlife Resources, it was the basically they suffocated to death. There are fish that survived down in the lower portion of the river, but everything from the confluence up to the dam was pretty much killed. The Division of Wildlife Resources estimated 5,250 fish based on their surveys, amount of fish per mile, and of course this includes fish of all species and size. But yeah, it was the amount of metals that are in this sediment are not high enough to be acutely toxic.
So it was really more suffocation of
the
sediment.
They just basically died of suffocation. Their gills got clogged and they died.
Okay, thank you. Just curious.
Any other questions, Council?
Can you just give a brief overview of the remediation plan for this event?
What has been taking place so far? The North Utah County Water Conservancy District is the responsible party. We've been in negotiations with them. They signed the settlement agreement last month. As I said before, the public comment period, 30-day public comment period, just ended on the 1st of May. And then it goes to the Water Quality Board for finalization. Part of the notice of violation settlement agreement was for them to perform a remediation of the river, removing contaminated sediments. And what they are doing is this spring they took the sediments that had collected in the irrigation reservoirs and the irrigation weirs down at the mouth of the canyon and took those and disposed of them. In November or October of last year, their contractor, environmental contractor working for them, took sediment samples from all the weirs and the irrigation ponds at the mouth of the canyon. And the basically the same amount. The amounts that he found are very close, if not almost identical, to the amounts that were known to be in the reservoir beforehand. I think his highest value of the sediment that was in the irrigation reservoirs was 652 parts per million lead. Highest value in the reservoir was 660 parts per million lead. So you have very good agreement with what was in the reservoir and what settled out in the irrigation ponds. As I said before, that sediment has been removed and disposed of at a permitted landfill. What's going to happen next is they're going to collect the sediment again at the end of this year, now that the water's going through the irrigation ponds and also the sediment basin at the mouth of the canyon. They'll test those again next year, determine how much we have or how much metals are there, and then depending on the concentrations of metals, remove those sediments again. And they're just going to repeat that on a yearly basis until the sample, the results, the levels of metals in the sediment that accumulates in these ponds equals the upstream background.
And what about sediment that's just on the bottom of the riverbed?
Excuse me?
What about sediment that's at the bottom of the riverbed?
Okay. It's determined that the simplest and easiest and most environmentally friendly way to get those down is just let the water bring them down. And this year, actually, it's going to bring down a lot because we're going to have an exceptional runoff. We still have about 140-150% snowpack up at the top of American Fork Canyon, so it's going to be a very strong runoff. You'll get a very good flushing. Part of the monitoring plan for the district has also agreed to a monitoring plan in August, late July, early August, depending on when the runoff ends. They are going to be taking samples from the river itself to see what the metals levels are after the runoff. And they're going to be monitoring this until the metals levels come down to what's considered to be background levels.
And at what point will they then notify the public that they can are safe to go in the river again?
Well, we're going to be discussing part of the reason the Utah County Health Department chose to keep up the signs is because they didn't have any new data. The sampling results from last year showed that there wasn't an excessive risk anyway, but out of an abundance of caution, they went ahead and put up the signs, and then they kept them up because of they didn't have anything to say otherwise. However, we are going to be getting more data, both from the sediment, irrigation system, and also the water data itself. These are samples that have been taken by the irrigation district. We'll also be sharing the data from Cedar Hills and our soil sampling efforts. And then Utah County Health Department will make a decision at that point. And I can't speak for the health department. I would be surprised if they keep the restriction in place, but that's up to them. That's not a DEQ issue. Mm-hmm. It's the local health department that makes that decision.
And when do the fish get repopulated?
The fish, there's part of the settlement agreement is the irrigation district is working with the Division of Wildlife Resources to work on a plan to evaluate when the fish population has recovered. Part of that will include sampling of fish for metals content, also population surveys. I don't know what the schedule of the Division of Wildlife Resources is intending to plant fish in the river to jumpstart the process, or if they're going to allow natural reproduction to take effect. As I mentioned before, the lower portion of the river, the American Fork River, from the confluence down to the mouth of the canyon, there still were plenty of fish there, in addition to the fact that you have an uncontaminated spot on the south fork of the American Fork River. They'll eventually get repopulated, but I don't know the timetable, and once again, I don't know what the plans are for the Division of Wildlife Resources. That will be determined in this plan that they are working out with the irrigation district that should be ready this summer.
Any other questions, Council? Kevin, thank you so much for being with us.
As I said before, thank you very much for allowing me to come and talk.
Thank you.
If you have any questions, you may contact me directly. I'll be glad to answer anything you may have.
So just so the council knows that we will be working with, I think it's Pleasant Grove Water, is that the name?
Pleasant Grove Irrigation Company.
Pleasant Grove Irrigation Company to put out a press release in conjunction with them with all the results that we have. And again, the results are on our website. We'll get them on the Cedar Hills Facebook page shortly, but we'll also do a press release that goes to the media with all of the results of our tests as well. Okay?
The only thing I would suggest is a clarification if you put those charts on, like the arsenic and, well, the cadmium and zinc, which the RSL doesn't show.
And he just said the RSL is so high that they put it on the chart.
It's on here, though. It's
on the back page.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, well.
I mean, just from a graphic standpoint, people look at it like, well, they don't know. Well, what's the
little safe level? Except for arsenic is there. That's the very low level.
There are several
and zinc are not on there.
That's right. If I may explain, the RSL is an EPA value that is for residential soils. Our screen level is actually for recreational. We use the RSL for lead because there really wasn't any other better one. And then we just use the RSL for arsenic for comparison. Once again, arsenic is very high, naturally high in background here. It's not unusual at all to find 10 parts per million arsenic virtually anywhere on any water. So.
Okay. Thank you so much for your time. Appreciate it. All right. Our next item is next couple of items. Items number 8 and 9. First is an action item on number 8, which is a resolution adopting fiscal year 2017 budget amendments. So, Mr. Lowe, time's yours.
Okay, let me try to go through these, and if you have any questions, let me know. In the general fund, we have some building fees and related costs that we're adjusting for. We also have passport revenue growth, revenues and costs, and recreation programs growth and costs. We also have a continual commitment to the Youth City Council and community arts revenue for future years. And we have a reverse of a transfer of $200,000 due to some delays in legal expenses that we were anticipating this spring. And we have a transfer of up to $400,000 to the capital projects and a transfer of $50,000 to the golf debt service fund. We have in the golf debt service fund receiving the transfer of $50,000. We have capital projects fund projects. The Bay Hill Park project was only partially bid out, approved only a partial amount of the project so far, and so it will need additional funding to complete the project. Golf maintenance building, this is to adjust to what was bidded out, and any adjustments that had to be made for fire and code requirements. There's also an adjustment for another cottonwood lot that was sold, and there's the transfers out. And in the water and sewer, there's the part related to the golf maintenance building site work and drainage. So, are there any questions?
Yeah, can you help me understand this? I'm sorry, I'm slow. I know I've seen these before, but it always takes me a little while to read them. So the very first line where it says building permits, it's got in parentheses 15,000 increase in revenues. Normally, if I see 50,000 increase, I'm thinking that's a negative number.
Credits.
So why does it say increase?
In revenue, when you talk about accounting, debits are an expense, which is positive. Credits are negative, which is a revenue. So that's why I put the language next to there.
Okay.
Increase in revenues.
So if I just read increase in revenues, then I can know that that's an increase in revenues there. And it just looks like that balances out, that we had some increase in revenues and we spent that on contract labor. Okay. So now that I understand that, then I just want to mainly understand these two big ones. You talked about delayed timing of legal expenses, and I just want to understand what's going on with that $200,000 and $400,000 and the $50,000 there.
So we transferred early $200,000 for legal expenses back in January, thinking that...
From where to where?
Capital projects to the general fund.
Okay.
It was, and we've anticipating that we'd have some litigation to deal with February, March, April, whatever, that really hasn't materialized yet.
Okay. So this is $200,000 going back into the capital projects fund. Okay.
For now. It might get moved right back in the next fiscal year, but for now, yeah.
And then the $400,000 going in
is to make sure that
is the usual thing we do every year to keep our
just in case.
It's sort of our extra revenue that we put
just in case.
Yeah.
I mean, our revenues don't get finalized till August, so we have to kind of if we don't want to get compliance. Now these budget amendments are hopefully covering everything, so we don't have to do it again in June.
Sure. And then the $50,000 transfer to the Gulf Debt Service Fund, is that just the normal anticipated transfer, or is this an addition?
So we are really close to we've been living off a little bit of the fund balance the last couple of years. So we're close to going negative, which would be a compliance item. So we can either not transfer the money in and raise the levy rate, or we can keep the levy rate flat and transfer this money in, and we should be good for a few years.
I see. And so do you have recommendations to whether we should increase the levy to make sure that the revenue is paid for?
I think it's okay leaving it flat and while we have and transferring the money in once in a while.
How long will this $50,000 last? How many years?
Could last 4 years.
So we're really only off by $12,000.
It looks like we're using about 12 to 15 a year, but it also depends on the motor vehicle fees and how well the economy is on that. So it's not, but it should last at least 3. It could last longer depending on the economy or.
I don't get it. This is debt service. Why would motor fees affect
so,
debt service
fees? Let me try to explain this because I probably do this once a year. When we do any kind of property tax levy, whether it's a school district or any other governmental entity, the county allocates motor vehicle fees based on your property tax levy. So we, because part of our property tax is related to debt levy, we allocate proportionally to what we levy to that fund. So we get $30,000, a little bit more, for our debt service, later motor vehicle fees, even though it has nothing to do with that, just like school district gets millions in motor vehicle fees, and it has nothing to do with school districts. It's just the way the system works. So our residents pay $309,000 in the levy. Our debt service is actually, you know, $35,000 more than that. So.
And so the rest of the debt service for the golf course is paid partly by motor vehicle fees.
Motor vehicle
and
fees.
Partly by this fund balance that we transfer in from the capital, from general fund.
Yep. So it's just a preference. I mean, I prefer to keep the levy flat, but no. Any other questions on the budget adjustments?
Are you ready for a motion? You done?
I think so.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Lowe. If you don't have any questions, I am ready to take a motion on item number 8. There is a suggested motion by Seth.
I move that we adopt resolution number 5-2-2017A, a resolution adopting the amended 2016-2017 fiscal year budget for the city of Cedar Hills, Utah.
Okay, I have a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Mr. Geddes seconds. Any further discussion? Let's have a vote. Starting from my left, Mrs. Reese.
Aye.
Mr. Geddes.
Aye.
Mr. Bailey.
Aye.
Mr. Zappala.
Aye.
Mr. Crawley.
Aye.
Motion was unanimous. Thank you very much. Let's move on to item number 9. Mr. Lowe, stay where you are. Keep on going.
Okay. Let's do our annual review of golf and water and sewer. Is this going to work? Maybe not. It always works right when I test it. Anyway, you probably have it on your own little iPad thing. So your first slide is about how does our pricing, our normal pricing, compare to other golf courses around the area, and generally, there we go. Cedar Hills is on the far left. Generally, we are a low cost leader, but a lot of golf courses don't actually make you pay normal prices all the time. So these are some of the deals other golf courses have. They have twilight rates, super twilight rates, military rates, junior rates. Hobble Creek's junior rates are like half price what their adult rates are. Temperature specials at Thanksgiving Point. So there's a lot of ways. We used to be more unique in doing coupons. Now it's becoming very common to do KSL deals, Groupons, that kind of things for other courses too. They saw what we were doing and they wanted a piece of that pie. Here is some of the courses around us. Fox Hollow always seems to struggle the most. They have the largest amount of population, but they're supporting it with $720,000 a year, which you can see at the very bottom is the contributions from the three cities. Spanish Fork has been doing pretty well with golf, and I think most of the golf courses with the last few years before this year enjoyed the really dry winters we were having. And so they could open earlier. But you can see in last year's budget, they had $775,000 they allocated for capital. In the previous years, they hadn't really been spending money on capital. That is for a clubhouse addition that they were spending on. This is Springville's budget. Springville's kind of had, I don't know, it was probably the first golf course, or at least successful public golf course in Utah County, and used to give quite a bit of money to their general fund because it was doing well enough. It's now hasn't really been reinvesting in itself, and so its clubhouse and its irrigation and stuff all need to be replaced, but it's still doing okay, but not compared to what they're used to. So it has a little subsidy. Payson had a running deficit over a few million dollars. They contributed 2.7 from their capital projects fund last year, similar to what we did back in 2012, our amount wasn't quite that large, and they still have a deficit of around $700,000, but they're working on it. So for this current year, the transfer in from other funds is going down by $5,000, and we are currently slightly less than last year. Our July and August were a little lower, and But when you look at historical numbers, we're still doing pretty well. And if we hit our average the last 3 months, we should be able to meet the budget still.
How many, so it shows 916,000 in 2016 and 842,000 in 2017. So that's down 60,000.
Now you're looking, you're comparing the budget. Okay, actuals and budget.
Yes. So do you think our budget's low? Do you think
part of that also includes transfers in. We try to take a three-year average. This city used to be aggressive, and we've tried to be conservative, and we need to be conservative because we're reinvesting in equipment at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Do you think we'll exceed that 842 this year then?
I think it's going to be close. Depending on if we have great May and June weather, I think we will.
So what do you think caused it to be down from 2016 overall? It sounds like we're not going to make as much as last year in revenues.
I think part of it is there's more competition on with places like the ranches and other places doing coupons. I think it's also partly the weather's not quite as good, but the pro shop has been doing better. The season passes have been doing better, but it's mostly been green fees.
Thanks. Mm-hmm.
Well, also, I think it looks to me like in 2016-17, even though those showed as season passes, they were really trades. So it's
okay,
about $30,000 a year, basically, right?
So, yeah, you have to be careful with the season passes.
Yeah, I mean, you can't really
so you look
season
at
passes
that,
are way down.
But if you just look at this year before trades, we're up a little bit.
Yeah, that's what I've heard.
So.
They're a little deceiving there, right?
And then the driving range bands construction.
Okay. Yeah, driving range has been down, and having the net down where people can actually use it is a good point. So, this is where we are versus. So the current year is green, and this is compared to our averages. So we've done better the last in February and March, but I think April might be a little down because it was wet. So on this chart, you can see green fees are slightly down, not dramatically, but slightly, and the pro shop and season passes are slightly up, practice range is slightly down. But you can see over the last, from 2012 to 2016, the Gulf's shown a slight increase in three major revenues. Okay, so highlights of the Gulf budget. I already talked about that the subsidy from other funds is going down, 142. So based on the acres, this is $160 per acre or irrigation acres. It's $2,630 per acre compared to our other city parks, which is $6,616 per acre. Plan is to replace our rough mowers and trade in. It will net about $97,000-$98,000.
Now the capital outlay of $110,000, that's offset, I guess, that's
with fund balance.
That's we get charged from the other fund.
No.
Isn't that, don't those go into, they don't, those don't go into,
no, the golf we have. Because they've done well enough the last 2 years, we're using fund balance.
Rather than going to...
Using the motor pool fund to fund it.
So we're not using the motor pool fund this time.
Right.
And, that,
or,
that's
and we didn't do that last year either.
I thought we didn't.
No, that was 2 years ago.
2015. Okay, gotcha. Yeah. Makes it really hard to track when it goes back and forth.
Yeah.
The capital outlays.
It's been... The last 2 years, we've been able to use fund balance because we've done better than the budget. If you're at the Gulf Finance Committee meetings, we were averaging about a $200,000 subsidy, and I think the last couple of years with buying equipment, we've been closer to $100,000. Golf cart agreement still has to be negotiated. That's going to be redone in February of next year. Some highlights. We have green fees increasing. That's based on basically a three-year average. And Pro Shop also increasing. That has been doing really well. And there's some offsetting costs that also go up with that. And then the wages, because we absorbed the person that was doing payroll, the allocation, there's less finance costs going, so the actual wages and benefits decreased by $600. Supplies increase for range balls, utilities increase, and we have some repairs and maintenance decrease in that. Any questions with the overall budget? Yeah.
Along the same lines of which fund to buy the assets into, why not be just consistent? And even when it's not the best year, why not buy it from the golf fund and then transfer money in from the general fund just for consistency? Because it really is confusing to know how much we've actually spent when it's sometimes in the motor pool fund, sometimes in the golf fund. And, you know, it's easy when you're trying to do an analysis to not know that something was purchased in the motor pool fund and to exclude it from cash outflows when you're trying to analyze it.
It's easy to say now when you have money, but sometimes we didn't have money in general fund or the golf fund, and so that's why we used the motor pool fund, because we were trying to get the cash price, because in the past the city would get a capital lease and pay more in interest. So we're just trying to avoid interest.
So we actually had no money to transfer from the general fund in 2000.
Well,
I thought we've always had a little excess there.
We've had some money, but it was also earmarked for Bay Hill Park and other projects like that. So you could say there's not just the golf fund that we're trying to fund, is my point. There's a lot of projects that people are trying to find.
If I remember right, we've always been up against the maximum in the general fund that we were allowed to have. Does that sound familiar, that conversation? You know what I mean? That there's a certain amount that you can have in the general fund, or else you bump up against the 25%.
Yes.
20%. So if we're always bumping against that, how could we not have, I mean, was it all earmarked, that entire 25%? Excess that we had?
No, the excess that got transferred got earmarked for the capital projects fund. At the time, we were just trying to max our general fund balance, because we didn't know. At every year, we don't know how well the revenues are going to do. The last couple of years, I've had the mayor and different people say, oh, it's going to go down sometime. So some people thought that our revenues would get worse. And so we were conservative. It did max out. But no one knew for sure that the revenues were going to go up or they were going to go down. And so it's really a guessing game, and so you can look past and say, oh yeah, we had excess money, but at the time nobody knew we were going to have that money until 6 months later. So it's really easy to say that looking back, but when you're looking at it at the time, we were being careful, saying, okay, we're going to max out what we can do in the general fund, and the excess is going to go for these projects. And the big reason why we used motor pool is we didn't know the golf course was going to do at the time as well as it is doing. Now that it is doing well, it can fund its own equipment, but at the time it wasn't a few years ago, it couldn't do that. It had a negative fund balance at one time. So
couldn't you, in that case, if you're going to take money from the motor pool fund, transfer it into the golf fund so that you see it spent that way? I think that's what Rob's looking for, is just so that it shows up consistently every year on this in the same place.
That's not how internal service fund works, though.
Okay.
And so if we knew at the time that the golf course was going to do as well as it was going to do, then we could have started that way. We've done it this way for the last 2 years, and we have been consistent the last 2 years.
I think 2015, isn't that the only year we used the motor pool fund? Because I know before that.
Yeah, it was just the very first year we came up with the equipment replacement plan. We weren't sure how we were going to fund all this equipment we need to replace, and we didn't have the fund balance at that time. The fund balance was probably like $20,000 in the golf fund, so it wasn't there, and we still had all these outstanding park projects undone, and there was just a lot of uncertainty.
So really only $100,000 is all we'd have to add, as far as
at the time, but we didn't know how.
But I mean,
yeah,
I'm not judging you. I'm just trying to figure out where the cash went. So $100,000 basically is all we've ever used in the motor fund.
Yeah, cool. That's right.
That's good to know. Thank you.
Okay, so I previously mentioned some facts about the golf debt service fund. We have originally had a bond issued in 2005, which was refunded in 2012. It was recently, the old bond was recently paid off because it was partially refunded. So our property tax debt levy right now, recommending that it remains flat, and that because there's chance for a fund balance deficit this year, that previous transfer will help provide a fund balance so that we can have $10,000 or $15,000 each year for the next few years to cover that.
How come we only levy $309,000? Yeah, we add the $30,000. That gets us up to $339,000 when you take the road fund addition. What gets us to the $384,000?
General fund.
Let me pull it up. Do you have the?
We could, as a council, decide that we would like that levy
right now
to exactly
actually
equal the outlays. And then we would have $10,000 to $15,000 that we could use for library reimbursements or something else.
It used to be $384,000. The actual debt service now is now $358,000. If you look at the debt service fund. I don't know. That's a typo. Sorry.
That's okay.
And we have $11,000 in delinquent taxes and $300 in penalties and interest. Okay, just a second.
Cheryl, do you need this?
Okay, some highlights from last year's water and sewer fund. We spent, out of the $3 million, about 29% on wages and benefits. We spent $518,000 on the sewer, and we spend on debt. You can see the interest and the principal part, if you add that together, that's close to $600,000 plus. Below, there's a $76,000 for excise tax bonds that we would transfer to in the past. So we were up to about $700,000 in debt service that the Water and Sewer Fund paid. So that's the main things. And then we have a lot of projects that maintenance things that we deal with. The TSSD's fees that we get have been all over the place. And so right now, most of the year it's been below the last couple years, and that's where we're at right now. Which is good. I'm not sure why this happens, but I just show it because it's kind of this weird anomaly that our sewer charges go up when our water usage goes down. And part of it might be naturally that we have more sewer. I mean, you have a lot of water that people use just maybe for their kids to play in the summer, so it doesn't actually go into the sewer pipe. But I don't know if people take longer showers in the winter, but it's not showing as in water usage, so I'm not it's kind of a weird thing. So here are the highlights. We have a pay-as-you-go plan that we've adopted since 2012 from Bowen and Collins, and it was updated last year. And it was to fund operational expenses and capital improvements that were needed, and it also helps offset what we have as very low impact fees and helps cover our we had issues before the Bowen Collins study covering our debt service coverage and keeping our loan covenants. So those are the increases based on the plan. The one change that I'm recommending is lowering the sewer to 3% from 5%, because when they did a CCAP study in the fall, some of the projects look like they're not needed in the next 10 years, and so I don't think we should do the full rate. But until we have a place, 3% is just a placeholder until the next update. There's also still some uncertainty that David Bunker talked about last year with the algae that was in Utah Lake and what TSSD is going to have to do to keep their wastewater cleaner than the water that comes from the mountains. If that ever happened, that would be extremely expensive. So 3% is kind of a safe thing to help there. If you look at the funds we have in the Water and Sewer Fund, we have about $2.7 million, which is better than we had a few years ago. If you look at Alpine, they have about $7.5 million. So why is there so much more? They fund full depreciation. We don't fund full depreciation.
Don't fund what?
Full depreciation. Oh, full depreciation. They're kind of in this weird limbo where they have a ton of money, but they feel like they don't have any money. And they have manual meters, but they say they don't have money to pay for them, but they do. They just don't want to fund the depreciation that comes with them. So they never do any project. I don't know. It's kind of weird. One of the big changes is we got rid of the transfers out from the Water and Sewer Fund. But to do that, we needed to move the excise tax debt service into the fund and have the general fund transfer debt half 50% of their amount to the Water and Sewer Fund. So that takes the debt service coverage to approximately 1.34, which slightly exceeds the minimum of 1.25. This is the impact fees that neighboring cities are getting. You have $9 million in Harriman, $5 million in Saratoga Springs, $51,000 in Cedar Hills.
That's just a function of the debt.
Yeah, exactly.
And you can't read too much more than that.
Yeah. But as far as funding any type of future projects, it can't really rely on that. And that's what this water sewer impact fee our debt service related to water and sewer qualifies as an impact fee expense, and so we track that, and it's so now we are have been going negative in that impact fee the last few years. Pending projects, we have storm drain site work for hopefully someday for Deerfield Park, Old Town storm drain retention, Canyon Road sewer potentially. We're still waiting on a bid for the work on Canyon Road. We have continual meter installation maintenance. We have Harvey Well and Cotton Well maintenance.
Are those replacements that we have to replace those chlorination stations?
No. Jeff, do you have input on that?
Yeah, we have no chlorination stations at this time. That's just in anticipation if the water quality requirements are...
If it does require, yeah. So it's 140 grand we may or may not spend.
They keep talking that all water providers will need to chlorinate at some level, but legislation keeps postponing that.
Charles, what's the Canyon Road sewer, 400,000?
So, that is the rate if we're do the full project that David had as a placeholder. Now, I think we were trying to see if we could do a partial bit of the that would cover most of the houses for less.
That's trying to get to our 2 or 3 or 10 or whatever number of people on the other side of the road that have septic tanks to replace their septic tanks, right?
Right.
Yep.
Yeah. I don't see the cost benefit working out on that one, but I've always disagreed with that.
Yeah. The vacuum truck, I have another slide later that goes into more detail on our different options with that. And then...
we might talk to
the Harvey Well replacement
going on the cost
eventually will need to happen where they'll have to actually dig a new well, I think, or clean the well. I don't know what they do, but so
the one in Heritage Park.
Yes.
The one we just took down and
did the motor.
The motor, yeah. The motor, and then we also got rid of the air and drain water, whatever it was. We lowered it, right? Is that right, Jeff? Is that the one that we lowered last summer?
We did the clean.
Yeah.
And we put in a controller, not a motor, motor controller, so we could reduce the amount of water we pour, so we don't need aeration.
And is it testing out good? Are we better at it?
It's working really well. But yeah, they have given us a projected life expectancy in which we would need to re-drill it or do a new one.
Sure.
So I've been calling around about vacuum trucks, and currently we have a ditch witch trailer with a 3-inch hose that needs to be replaced. Public Works still needs to do demos on various trucks that other cities use so they know what works. One of the issues we have is because we're on that hillside and we have a smaller storage area, the normal size super large vacuum truck probably doesn't even fit. Like when you go to the demos, well, it probably could, but it would be really hard to maneuver. They're like, they can be 40 feet long. And I don't know if you've ever seen a 40-foot vacuum truck, but trying to picture it like going around the corner and everything would be pretty hard, especially in the winter. That makes it a little hard to rent one that big for a month, too, because you wouldn't really be able to fit it. So they've looked at a smaller truck, a single axle. The issue is a lot of cities around here only have double axles. There's not a lot of demos available, so we're trying to find something.
Hey, Cheryl, is there a possibility of parking it down by the maintenance building?
Well, it still needs to be covered.
Oh, does it?
So you'd have to build a building for it.
Oh, I didn't realize you were talking about covering it.
Yeah, it has to be covered. or it will deteriorate, and it's a big investment, you know. So right now, some of the rates, if we just call someone to come do it on contract, you can get 24-hour service, I found out. It's $300 after hours per hour, $200 per hour during the daytime. So after 7 o'clock at night, if you call, they'll charge you $300 an hour. That might be okay if we don't have that many instances, and maybe we just use that for emergencies and then get a cheaper truck or something. So we're still working with all these vendors. We're want to do something that makes sense. I don't think we're looking at what AF just got, a $490,000 vac truck, you know, that has all the bells and whistles. We're looking for a smaller single axle, but that's still functional for our city and doesn't get clogged so easy. So that's still in process. It might take us a couple months, might take another year of trying to figure out what's best, but we're working on it. So recent activities, you know, a lot of these, the latest I just found out is there was a landslide with Central Utah Project that might cut off our water part of the year this year. I don't know if Chandler said it could be off for a month, I think.
There was the, we were notified that out by Cascade Golf Course, they had an incident with 27 acres that had compromised the integrity of the line that services downstream users, Cedar Hills being one of them. At this point, they're still able to deliver water. There haven't been any plans I've seen that indicate that they're going to have to install a bypass line. So we're hopeful at this point that there will be no interruption of service. But that was a possibility, and it's one of those incidences where you're grateful that it happened in the watering off season rather than in the watering peak season. You don't ever want these types of events to occur, but the timing was good because we're not at a point where we rely on that water. However, if that event were to occur in August or July and it did compromise our ability to receive that water, we would be in for some serious restrictions as far as watering schedules go.
Is that the NWD line, the big one?
That's the CUP line.
So this is just charts on water usage and what Owen Collins has said. One of the things I have to let you know is by moving excise tax bonds into the Water and Sewers Fund, we really don't have any capacity, even if we wanted to issue debt in the Water and Sewers Fund at this time. So the only way that we could add meters is through some kind of financial incentives from the state or grants or something, or we have to save up for it. Right now,
you couldn't bond for it?
Not at this time, because there's not the capacity in our to meet debt service coverage requirements.
What happened? What changed since Bowen Collins recommended
this? Well, the excise tax bonds were in the capital projects fund, and then when we took all the transfers out from water and sewer fund and put excise tax bonds in the water and sewer fund, that added $150,000 principal and debt payments, which made the ratios go down to 1.3. You only can go to 1.34. You can only go to 1.25. So there's only a few thousand dollars that we can add and still meet our loan requirements, or they can call the debt.
And why did we decide to do that?
And so why did we move excise tax bonds? Because the new legal laws where you'd have to, now we can change that.
Yeah, we'd have to hold those hearings.
We'd have to have special hearings. We'd have to notify Facebook.
That's okay.
Internet. We can, but we'd prefer not to unless it's an emergency. Now, if it's an emergency, we need the debt. Then we can do it.
We'd go back, right, and do that.
We would
clear our space.
I don't know about emergency, but you have materials, and we know from Bowen Collins that we have excess wear and tear on our PI system because of
the way we're pumping high capacity through it.
Right. So
the alternative is saving up.
Yeah.
But saving up means we sure hope there's not a pump failure at the right time in that next amount of time, or we're sunk.
So
I might qualify that as an emergency.
Right. So it depends on...
And I wouldn't.
Yeah. So I haven't got any push for meters lately because of all the rain, which has nothing to do with the stress on the system. But that's up to the council. If they want to do that, they can, but there's a lot of...
What we're doing is we're basically gambling. Right? We're gambling that there's not going to be a critical failure in a key component of the system that will mean that we cannot allow people to use irrigation water during the high part of the season. We're gambling that that won't happen while we save up money for meters.
But meters wouldn't stop.
So it really comes down to...
Meters are more managing, though.
What are the odds that we might have a catastrophic system failure while we wait to save up until, what is it, 2025 on your chart? And we should talk to our public works folks and say, what are the odds? And are we willing to gamble?
I would say public works wants meters right away. But it's also what your residents want, too. And so you have to balance that with what your residents want.
And then that, of course, gets balanced with, if we put in meters, then we also have to have enough incentive for people to cut back on their water usage so that we actually do reduce wear and tear on the system, right? Which means
especially if there's a breakdown.
Tiered pricing systems in place.
Right, right. And if the majority of you guys want that, then we can see what we can do. But that's not the impression I've received.
I think we need to have a serious discussion sometime in the next few months.
Yeah. So this is one of the things you'll notice with our rates. I wanted to point out Alpine, that has some of the lowest utility rates and some of the advantages they have. They have spring water. They don't have to pump their water. They don't have to buy any supplementary water. So that ends up being about $400,009 in supplementary and pumping costs that they don't have to pay that we do every year. The other thing is they have really bad service. They only measure their meters twice a year. So if anyone has a leak, they might find out about it 6 months later. That's probably the main items. But there's, and also we just, because the way our water's set up, all of it gets pumped to the top of the mountain. And they get more money per household just based on the size of their lots are much bigger than ours. So even if they charge less for a quarter acre lot, they're getting more money per household. Are there any questions about the water and sewer fund?
Cheryl, that was very in-depth. Thank you. Any questions, council?
So, okay. Just looking at this thing.
Are you? Go ahead.
Just one quick question.
Yeah.
The paramedic fee that's added on to ours.
Yeah.
How come Highland and Alpine don't have that? Because we're part
of Alpine has $1, I think.
Who does?
Alpine. They do $1.
But why not Highland? We're all part of the same.
It was how their council decided to fund it.
Yeah.
Do I have two other council members who are willing to have a discussion about meters in the next couple months?
About metering?
Yeah.
I'm willing to.
I'd do it next time.
We will talk about meters anytime you want. And so I'm glad you two are down there, because I know one's going to take one side, the other's going to take the other side, and it'll balance each other out. So
who's going to present?
We will definitely bring that.
That's a great question.
Anything else?
No, we need to pass the tentative budget just by legal.
I get that. So if anyone has questions, ask them now. If not, then we're going to make a motion on the tentative fiscal year FY18 budget, which starts July of this year.
I'll make a motion to approve the tentative fiscal year 2017-18 budget.
Okay, I have a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Mrs. Reese seconds. Any further discussion? Let's have a vote. Mrs. Reese.
Aye.
Mr. Geddes.
Aye.
Mr. Bailey.
Aye.
Mr. Zappala.
Can I have a discussion question before voting?
Say that again?
Can I have a discussion on this before voting?
I just asked for it. No one said, but I'll go back and give
you
a discussion.
My hearing was bad. I didn't hear. Okay. We're voting on a proposed budget. Do I have the proposed budget in front of me? Is it in one of these memos?
It should be.
It's number 9.
9A.
Aha, thank you. That's what I was looking for.
It's tentative and it will
And we've seen this already before. Is this correct, or is there anything changed?
We will come back with the final budget.
Right, but from the last time we had a presentation where I remember looking through this, has anything changed since then?
Yes.
Can you tell me what?
Hire a city manager, so there's been changes for that. And
so did you say aye?
No, I'm asking still, what has changed since the last time we reviewed this?
That I think I've covered any changes in the presentation other than the city manager changes.
Okay. Great. Thank you. I'm an aye.
Okay. Mr. Crowley.
Aye.
Vote was unanimous. Thank you very much. Let's move on to item number 10, also an action item. This is on an ordinance amending Title III of the City Code relating to business licenses. Mr. Goodwin, time is yours.
So the code that you have before you is essentially the same as the code that was presented to the council 2 weeks ago. In light of Senate Bill 81, which limits the city's ability to require a license fee for home occupation businesses. So if you look in your budget, you can see the fiscal impact that this has on the city. We're potentially looking at $25,000 reduction in business license revenues. Now that's for licensing. So the way that we're going to tackle this, and our business licensing department's called a number of cities, and there's a lot of cities that are kind of in the dark on this one and kind of scrambling on how they're going to adopt. And we are trying to err on the side of the resident and make things easy. So what we have are a couple designations in the definitions of the proposed code. You have a home-based office, which is defined as a business conducted entirely out of the home, where the public and or employees do not enter the home, where there's nothing produced, and where there's not a material impact. Anybody that qualifies for this type of business, home office, will not be required to have a business license. We're not going to require that for them. The other designation is a home-based business. A business conducted entirely out of the home, the public and or employees may enter the home, goods may be produced, and there may be a material impact. A home-based business is required to have a business license. Now, if you have no material impact, there will be no fee for a business license. If you have a material impact, there will be a fee. These home-based businesses will, however, still be required to have an inspection. If the public enters their home, whether it's music lessons, dance lessons, whatever it may be, there will be an inspection fee. For new businesses, there still is going to be a setup fee because there is some administrative work that's involved there. That's $20, and inspection is $25. If anybody wants a copy of their business license, some people want that for tax purposes, there is a $5 charge for that. So that's where we are. Those are the only changes in terms of, and those fees are already adopted in our fee schedule. There just is not a fee for the actual license that we normally charge, which is $65.
So Chandler, can you clarify what has changed since the last time you talked to us about this?
I think the only thing that we've changed that I can remember is under the home-based business, the definition, there's the last sentence that says a home-based business is required to have a business license. So we're still going to require them to have a business license. However, 90% of them aren't going to have to pay for that.
Okay.
For the actual license. If it's a new business, then there's still going to be a setup fee. So there'll be a $20 charge. And if the public enters, there's going to be a $25 charge for an inspection. So there's a $55 fee for the setup and for the inspection. But typically, we would charge $65 for the license as well. And that's not going to happen in these cases.
Then every year, is there still a renewal at all? I mean, if you want the certificate.
No, if you want to print out of your business license, it's $5. But if you're already set up, there's no setup fee. If you already have an inspection, most likely you don't have another inspection fee. So it's most of those are one-time fees.
And if you're under 18, there's no license required.
If it's operated occasionally.
Yeah.
So if you have an 18-year-old that is running a legitimate business day in, day out, and there's a material impact, there could be a license fee. But that the code there is really for lemonade stands, soda cookies, things like that, that are operated only occasionally, and those are the ones we're going to ignore. And typically, we've ignored those in the past. We've never dealt with those. We've treated those as only temporary.
So, at least in my business, sometimes I'm asked for a yearly, an updated business license.
Yeah.
So I would still continue to have to pay $5.
Yeah, you'd pay $5, get the paper certificate mailed to you, and then you'd be good to go.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Any questions, counsel? I will take a motion on this action item. There is a suggested motion if you're looking.
And sorry, the motion should read that it's to approve ordinance, not just changes to the code.
I move that we approve ordinance 5-2-2017A, dissolving the I'm looking at the wrong one. No, because the first one was a resolution. Sorry, some of these are PDFs and some are Word documents, so I'm having to go back. Okay. I move that we approve. It doesn't say resolution or.
It should be ordinance. Oh, it should be ordinance.
We approve ordinance number 5-2-2017A to approve the changes to the Cedar Hill City Code Title III related to business licensing subject. Oh, we don't have any changes.
Okay. I have a motion. Is there a second?
I will second.
Mr. Zappala seconds. Any further discussion?
Does the state require us to implement that? I mean, does it go into effect immediately then?
We're treating this as going into effect as the day that the governor signed the bill. So that's a good question, because there's some people that paid for a new license in February. We can't go back retroactively, but once the governor signed the bill and it becomes state law, that's where we're going to treat it. So we've been holding some checks. We're going to return some of those. Some people, we're just going to have to give them the good news that they don't need a business license anymore. We can't go back.
Yeah.
So there's a date, and it's going to be March 24th from the date the bill was signed.
Okay, that's
my question. Okay. If there's no further discussion, let's have a vote. So, Mrs. Reese.
Aye.
Mr. Geddes.
Aye.
Mr. Bailey.
Aye.
Mr. Zappala.
Aye.
Mr. Crawley.
Aye.
Motion was unanimous. Thank you very much. Let's move on to item number 11. Mr. Goodwin's going to present this, but we're dissolving some of the committees that we have. If we need to reconstitute them in some future point in time, we will. But they're just not being used and may not be used for a long period of time. So, Chandler, go ahead.
Yeah, one of the problems we had with this is we want to get into the habit of dissolving committees when they're no longer meeting and then reconstituting them with whoever the new members are when they are needing to meet again. A good example is the Golf Course Finance Committee. It was originally dissolved back in its first iteration, and then when they started meeting again in, was it 2016? Last year?
2015.
They started meeting, but it wasn't ever reconstituted. So if we just know that these are dissolved, that they have to be reconstituted, and we can appoint the new members and have a clean process of how we go about doing this, this is an effort to just kind of establish some protocol as far as committees are concerned. This isn't meant to say that these committees can never meet again, but they will have to be reconstituted.
Can I make a small request?
Yes.
I've asked this before, and it keeps never getting done, but I'd really, really like on the Golf Course Financial Advisory Committee to list both presentations that the committee has created to date. If you look for the one that was created back in 2012, it's really, really hard to find. It takes me 10 minutes of Google searching just to even find it on the website.
Okay. I will look
it that. Shows the 2015 report there, but not
the previous one. I will arrange to have that link right below the 2015.
That would be awesome.
Okay.
Thank you. All right. I'll take a motion on this item.
I move that we approve Resolution 5-2-2017A, dissolving the General Plan Citizens Advisory Committee, the Golf Citizens Advisory Committee.
B.
The Town Hall Citizen Advisory Committee and the Water Conservation Citizens Advisory Committee of the City of Cedar Hills, Utah.
Thank you very much. I've got a motion. Is there a second?
I'll second.
Mr. Crowley seconds it. Any further discussion? Mr. Crowley. What's that?
You sounded surprised. We work well together.
Yes, we do. So Mr. Crowley seconded it, and you're going to start with the vote.
Aye.
Mr. Zappala.
Aye.
Mr. Bailey.
Aye.
Mr. Geddes.
Aye.
Mrs. Reese.
Aye.
Motion was unanimous. Thank you very much. Moving on to item number 12, also an action item. This is an ordinance amending Title I, Chapter 7A of the City Code relating to campaign finance disclosures. Mr. Goodwin, continue on.
This is also an effort to be in compliance with state code. Recent changes to state code require that any anonymous donations, and Colleen, correct me if I'm wrong, any anonymous donations made to a candidate's campaign need to be either donated to a nonprofit or to the city. They can no longer accept anonymous donations. Is that correct?
Yeah, the city or the state or the county.
Just anybody. You can't keep anonymous donations.
So we're doing that to match with the new changes from last year in the code.
Was it last year?
This year.
Okay.
But if I'm reading it, it says that exceed the contribution limit of $50. So if you get an anonymous donation of $20, you can keep it.
Yes. Okay.
$49.99. Do you have more to present, Chandler?
That's it.
Thank you. Okay. I'll take a motion on this item if there's no questions. If you have questions, fire away.
I move that we approve, that we adopt ordinance number 5-2-2017B, an ordinance amending Title I, Chapter 7A of the City Code of the City of Cedar Hills, Utah, relating to campaign finance disclosure requirements and definitions.
Okay, I have a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Mrs. Reese seconds. Any further discussion? Start with Mrs. Reese.
Aye.
Mr. Geddes?
Aye.
Mr. Bailey?
Aye.
Mr. Zappala?
Aye.
Mr. Crowley?
Aye.
Motion was unanimous. Thank you very much. Continuing on, item number 13. It's an action item on an interlocal agreement with the county regarding the by the vote by mail proposal. So go ahead, Mr. Goodwin.
As you're already aware, Cedar Hills is one of the first cities in Utah County, probably in Utah, I believe, to do vote by mail. Other cities are seeing the trend there, taking to the trend there, and are wanting to do this as well. This year's election is being proposed to be administered by Utah County. It should be, so Utah County will be in charge of administering all the vote-by-mail elections, including the processing, mailing, and counting of the ballots. The cost of the election will be shared between the county and the individual cities, as long as there's an interlocal cooperation agreement. And this is actually, we're actually getting a deal on this because we're, part of the county is they get the bulk mailing rate, correct? Whereas if we were doing this by a city, we'd be paying the standard mailing rates. So we're actually saving some money by going with the county on this.
The only other question I had, I already asked Colleen, but I'll just share with everybody else, was I asked if residents could, some residents don't like to mail it in. They want to go to the city office and still drop it off in a ballot box. And she said, yes, that's still the case.
Yeah, we would have a ballot box in the front desk where, like we've had in years past.
Okay.
Are we able to still go and vote in person?
Say that again.
This year, are we able to still go vote in person, though? Will there be...
is there a vote in person on the day of the election?
You can bring your absentee ballot or your vote by mail ballot and fill it out at the city office and drop it in the ballot box. But yes, if anyone does not,
I will come and watch you do it if you want someone to be there.
Well, I have an issue with this because of the voter fraud that, you know, happens around elections. And also I heard of several instances in our city where people got two ballots, or some people didn't get ballots, or some people that moved got ballots and maybe they were forwarded to where they were so they could still vote. There's a lot of questionableness when we're dealing with a vote by mail. And a lot of conservative groups out there really are concerned about this issue. And Lowell Nelson, who I respect a lot, he's been in Republican Party leadership. He's been pretty vocal about how this is not a good trend. And there are some things he mentioned. He says, how do you know that the votes cast by mail are cast by citizens who are registered to vote in your city? How do you know that the person whose signature appears on the ballot is the person who actually cast the vote? How do you know that someone didn't sign for their spouse? You know, if I disagree with my wife on something, I could grab her vote and sign it. How do you know that a vote cast by mail is actually delivered to and counted by an election judge? And he goes on. There's higher costs because you have to pay postage to every registered voter in the entire city. I don't think there's proof that it lowers costs. In fact, I think it's the opposite.
No, I'm not saying it's lower cost. I'm saying it's a lower cost versus us doing it ourselves.
Right.
So, okay.
So anyway, I am very much against it at this point. I voted for it last time, but I've done a lot of research since then, and I'm very much against it.
Colleen, do you mind speaking to some of the issues as far as verifying a signature, what the process there is?
How we receive
ballots and how
the county is actually the register office for voters. So they have signatures. They have a big database where the ballots come in, they open them, and they verify the signatures. They have three or four different places they can look to verify it. If there's any question whatsoever, if they're going to reject it for any reason at all, the voter is contacted and saying, hey, guess what? This doesn't match. All you have to do is fill out this new affidavit, sign it. If it matches your current signature, then yes, we'll count it. They've actually even changed it in the law that you have to contact the voter within a certain amount of days, and that was one of the bills that passed this year. So they do have a pretty good system on how to verify signatures. I've done it myself. It's pretty cut and dry. It either matches or it doesn't. And when it doesn't, you contact the voter. Ballots do not get forwarded if someone has moved. That's against the law. It even says that they're to go right straight back. In this instance, everything's going to be going to Utah County by mail. The only ones that we'll have in our office are people who drop them off at our ballot box. And then on election day, if they say they do not have a ballot, didn't get one, they can come into our office on election day and fill out a provisional ballot. What that does is just make them fill out and sign an affidavit, vote their ballot, put it in that provisional envelope, and then it goes to the county. Once the county verifies they are a registered voter and the signatures match, then that vote gets counted.
And didn't the county change their policy too? So I remember last time there was a huge delay in the absentee ballots.
They did.
They can now give daily updates now, isn't that correct?
It wasn't necessarily the county. It was the legislators who didn't want to wait for that full 2 weeks between the election day and the canvass. So now, on any day that ballots are counted, you must release the results.
Of that
so you don't count. Have to. You can wait 2 weeks. But if you count them that day, you have to release the results.
I think that will help a lot.
Oh, yeah.
So, Colleen, is it too soon to ask whether there's been any reports of voter fraud yet, and is there a way to track it, or is that not something?
You know, that would be something that the Lieutenant Governor's office would have information on. We could find out.
Okay.
But, again, I think if it was something that was really, really high risk and lots of problems, we would have heard about it already in the news, because there are so many counties and cities that have gone to vote by mail this last election.
Thank you.
I'll just share some statistics. State of Oregon has had vote by mail since the year 2000. They've reported they have cast 15 million ballots during that time. They have had thousands of fraud complaints, people alleging fraud has occurred. They've investigated all those. They've resulted in 9 total prosecutions out of 15 million ballots cast.
So it's pretty minimal.
But a lot of the problem is, how would you know? There's more opportunities, I guess, for fraud, I believe, with vote by mail.
I think there's as much opportunity, in my opinion, as, you know, going the day of and, you know, just looking over the list and saying that's you or whatever. But my only question is, where does the database of signatures come from? Driver's licenses and things? Or?
Actually, when you sign up to register to vote, that's your main signature. But they also, in their database, have other, like your driver's license ones and things that they have access to through their
It's called VISTA. It's a voter information system that's pretty secure.
I thought about registration for vote, but I guess that's on there because you would have mm-hmm. in order yeah, to get yeah. a ballot. Okay, thank you.
On all your county documents that are associated with you, there's mm-hmm. a lot of signatures yeah. that you've probably signed that are down with the county, whether you know it or not.
Yeah.
So, Mr. Crawley, I understand your concerns. If all those questions that you mentioned, if you want me to ask the Lieutenant Governor's office who's over elections, I'm happy to do that and get responses for you.
Can we maybe continue this to the next meeting then?
Can we do what?
Continue this vote to the next meeting and vote on it then after we get a little more information.
Okay, you're going to have to make a motion and see if you get any support.
Okay, yeah, I'd make a motion that we continue this discussion until next meeting.
Okay, I have a motion. Is there a second? I'm sorry, Mr. Okay. Crawley, there was no second.
Okay.
So, any questions for Mr. Goodwin or Ms. Mulvey? If not, I will take a motion on this item.
Ms. Mulvey, what letter are we on? Is it C?
For this, we will be C.
So I move that we approve resolution number 5-2-2017C, authorizing the execution of an interlocal cooperation agreement between Utah County and the City of Cedar Hills, Utah, regarding the administration of the 2017 municipal elections.
I have a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Mr. Bailey seconds it. Any further discussion? Start from my right. Mr. Crawley.
Nay.
Did you say nay?
Nay.
Okay. Mr. Zappala.
Aye.
Mr. Bailey?
Aye.
Mr. Geddes?
Aye.
Mrs. Reese?
Aye.
Motion was 4-1 in favor of the ayes. Ayes pass. Moving on to item number 14, action item. This is on a resolution notifying the Utah County Commission of the City's intent to submit to the voters an opinion question regarding the possible imposition of a park, PAC, PARC tax. Mr. Goodwin?
Yeah. As part of being on the ballot, we want to propose to the City Council that we put the park rather than the care tax on the ballot. It's the same tax, it's a little clearer for the public what the use of it is. It's for parks, arts, recreation, and culture. It's 0.1% increase in local sales and use tax as a means of enhancing funding for local recreational facilities and cultural organizations within the city. The park program is committed to enhancing city recreational and cultural facilities and providing fair and equitable access to park funding of cultural organizations. And, so we want to put this back on the ballot. We feel like it's an important element in the city's recreation program. We have committees that use it. We've been really responsible with funding and doing projects with it. We've used a wide variety of uses over the years. So this is something that staff feels is something that's important for the city. So we'd like to put it on the ballot.
What's the difference? I mean, why aren't you proposing the care tax?
It's the same. It's known as a few things. It's a care tax.
The ZAP tax,
the park tax. They're all essentially the same thing, just different names.
Why don't we just call it the care tax like we did last time so we don't have to retrain everyone what it is?
We're not trying to train people, but I think park makes it a little more clear to people what it actually is.
I think the problem last time was that we've always used care tax for things like the basketball courts at Heritage Park or park-related things. We've never used care tax for recreation programs.
No.
But because the care tax said cultural arts or recreation or whatever, there was an assumption or a perception given that the money collected from care tax was used for recreation programs, which was not true.
Yeah.
So we're trying to clarify and better explain to residents that it's going to actual facilities or parks.
Correct.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Goodwin on this? Not, I'll take a motion.
Go ahead.
I move to approve resolution number 5-2-2017C.
D.
A resolution notifying the Utah County Commission of the City of Cedar Hills intent to submit an opinion question to Cedar Hills residents regarding the possible imposition of a citywide tax to fund cultural, recreational, botanical, and zoological organizations or facilities in the City of Cedar Hills.
Okay. I have a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Mrs. Reese seconds it. Any further discussion? Start from my left. Mrs. Reese.
Aye.
Mr. Geddes.
Aye.
Mr. Bailey.
Aye.
Mr. Zappala.
Aye.
Mr. Crawley.
Maybe.
Maybe can't work.
No,
No, I mean, I'm going to say I'm always in favor of residents getting a vote on something. I'll say yes.
Did you say yes or no?
Yes.
Okay. Vote was was unanimous in the affirmative. Thank you very much. Moving on to item number 15, also an action item on a resolution to discontinue our membership with the Utah League of Cities and Towns. Mr. Goodwin, go ahead and present.
This is a resolution that was being proposed by Councilmember Crawley. I just want to give a little background on the city's involvement with ULCT and what exactly ULCT does for us. You're all aware of the trainings opportunities that ULCT provides to elected officials, planning commission members, city staff. They have their two annual biennial conferences, one in St. George, one in Salt Lake, over the course of a few days, and they go over a number of topics. In addition to that, they have a road school, which I believe is this week in St. George, and they do land use trainings for planning commissions, city councils all throughout the state, and board of adjustments as well, in an effort to educate the public that are doing public service on what their exact role is. In addition to that, ULCT provides staff with recommendations on local legislation. In fact, item number 17 tonight regarding the city's improvement bonds, coordinating that with ULCT was key for staff getting the information that we needed. We had to reach out to Meg Ryan from the league and Jody Hoffman as well, and they quickly responded with information on what the legislation was, giving us clear guidance that we needed. So ULCT, they are a lobbying group, and they do promote cities' interests at the state level. For example, this last year, they had 1,272 bill requests. 815 bills of those were bills considered, and 535 were bills passed, 66% of the bills that were considered. ULCT tracked...
Hold on a second. You're telling me that 565 bills in Utah...
535
were originated by ULCT?
No, these are bills that legislature passed.
These are by the people you elect. ULCT just tracks them.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
No. Sorry, don't misunderstand me there. ULCT does not draft the bills. They work with people to draft the bills. They work with the legislators in the Legislative Policy Committee to help draft the bills and give the city's perspective. Of those 815 bills that were considered in this last legislative session, ULCT tracked 283 of them. If you've ever, during the legislative session, gone to the ULCT website, they have a bill tracking section where you can kind of see their hot button issues and where their support is on it. Of those 283 bills, 187 of them, 66% passed, 16 did not, or sorry, I don't know how that reads. They kind of classify them as green, red, and orange, and yellow based on the intensity of their level of support. But they meet with the sponsors, they make amendments, they do testimony down at the state legislature in the committees, and they do research and fiscal notes to try to help the legislatures make the best decisions possible. They work to preserve local control from the state level. They want to make sure that the cities, when it comes to planning, to zoning, to things that happen on the city level, they want to make sure that the cities are the ones that get to decide what happens on their city level. They have been in support of various taxes. The gas tax last year was a big item for them. And I think that that's because they see see the need for cities to be able to fund infrastructure improvements. A lot of cities around us have road issues that they're trying to address currently. And ULCT is trying to find ways in order to have people or give them the funding that they need. There is a cost to being a member of ULCT. Currently, we got our invoice for the next fiscal year. The city pays $5,000. The city's invoice is for $5,118.71. That's based on your assessed property values. It's a formula that they use. It's based on assessed property values, population estimate, and a sales tax revenue. And that includes your membership fee. So with that,
What did that do from fiscal year last year?
I believe it's pretty similar. It's always regionally around $5,000. Is that around, right, Cheryl?
Yeah, it sounds like it might be slightly less.
Okay. With our stable growth, we can pretty much.
But our population went down slightly.
So, are there questions on ULCT that I can answer. Councilman McCrawley, this is his resolution. I invite comment from him.
Any questions, council members?
I have comments, but I figured I'd let you start since this is your resolution.
Yes, I'd love to. First of all, I know that you can pay to go to the training. I think the training's helpful, and I know you can pay to go to it without paying the fees. You might get a little discount if you pay the membership fees. So I don't doubt that that's helpful. It is nice to get together with other council members from other cities. I also, the legal service, I'm sure we could go to our attorney and get some of the same answers, so I'm sure we could live without that piece. The problem I have with it is that it's almost like a government appendage now, because so many states, so many cities are funding it, and it's a very powerful lobbying group. But I don't think that their lobbying efforts are always in favor of residents. And the biggest trigger for me was that gas tax, where so much of our funds went to UTA on that gas tax. And they took credit for it passing. They said it wasn't going to pass. They got everyone involved and told them how to talk to the residents into voting for the gas tax. And the residents generally want lower taxes, and they want, funding locally, or want roads funded. If we're going to fund it through gas tax, they want most of it to go to our local roads, not necessarily a company like UTA. Yet they had the lobbying power to make that happen. So I feel like the residents, it's a strange circle in which the residents give the city money. The city gives a small portion, be it, but it's still a portion of our tax money to a group like this that then tries to convince the residents how to vote, to raise taxes. And when you're come into public office, then you sometimes take off your resident hat and put on your city hat and think, okay, the goal is to increase revenue for the city rather than to decrease taxes. And so I think that they're leaning more towards, okay, how can we increase the funds for the city instead of how can we decrease taxes for residents? And so the residents are basically funding something, a group that's going against their interests through us. And I just don't agree with that part. I don't agree with their lobbying efforts. They've generally been more liberal than I like to be, and so I'm against it.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Kralik. And Mrs. Reach, I think you want to make a comment. Is that true?
Yeah. So I understand what Councilmember Crawley is saying about the gas tax, and I appreciate that. I know that I think what happened with UTA was a compromise that ULCT had to agree to in order to get something to work. And I know there's been some question about some financial practices that they've had recently, and those are concerns. And I would actually like ULCT to maybe come meet with us at some point and address how they're resolving those issues. But I think in addition to advocating for revenue per city, they've also done quite a few things that have benefited us. Grandma Law was a big one for us a few years ago, where there was a bill that was being supported that would have been very hard for a city of our size to live with. Zoning laws, we just talked about the being able to do short-term rentals, and the original bill that came forth really took municipalities' ability to create zoning laws for their own cities away, and so ULCT advocated on behalf of cities for that. In addition to that, we do have the training. We have access to their legal team, to their policy experts. Like Chandler said, they provide daily updates and tracking information. But for me, the big thing is that ULCT gets their marching orders from the Legislative Policy Committee, which is made up of elected officials from throughout the state. So ULCT is doing what the LPC is telling them to do. And we've only had one member of our team serve on the LPC, and that's Mayor Gigi. We have the ability to have our city manager and two city council members, and I think assistant city manager, no, we don't have that anymore, and the mayor serve on the Legislative Policy Committee. There's not a limit to how many people from our city, other than we can't have more than two council members, serve on the LPC. And because ULCT gets their marching orders from the LPC, I think it makes more sense for us to, if we're concerned about the direction ULCT is going, to have elected officials step up and serve on the LPC to have a voice. Because ULCT is going to be a powerful lobbying organization whether we're a member of it or not. But whether or not we have a voice in that process is going to be determined on whether or not we are members of ULCT. So I don't think that it makes sense for us to walk away from that membership and now not have anybody lobbying for the small cities at the state legislature. I think it makes more sense for more people on this team to participate in the LPC to make sure that whatever concerns we have are being heard.
I find I don't need a lobbyist. I just call my representative up and tell them how I feel about things, and that's pretty effective a lot of times. But on top of that, we just can't serve on the board of every single group out there, special service district. I mean, that's another problem I have, is you grow so many appendages to the government so big that you just cannot monitor all of them and make sure they don't do questionable practices like we're finding they have done recently. So I'm in favor of smaller government, and government always tends to creep bigger and bigger through these types of groups and through special service districts, etc. And so, that's my comeback.
Thank you. So I understand your points for sure. I think that I am also concerned about small government. And so for the 6 years that I've been an elected official, and the 2 years in particular when I sat on ULCT's board, I never saw any real or even perceived conversations where they're lobbying for anything other than what their city members want them to lobby for. And so to the extent that you feel like they're lobbying liberal ideas, then Mrs. Reese is right. Then let them know, either through myself or if you want to participate in the Legislative Policy Committee, you can.
Did you know that fund existed when you were on that board?
What's that?
Did you know that fund existed when you were on the board, the one that's been in question?
I'm not hearing
you. Did you know that fund existed that's been in question when you were on their board?
He's referring to the fund that's been in the news that was the fund that CEO and CFO used.
You didn't know that was there?
No, I think that was a total surprise to everyone on the board. And so there was one employee who appears to maybe have done something criminal, and even the director, no one says he did anything criminal, he just didn't supervise very well. And so, I think that they will figure out what policies to put in place in order to make sure it doesn't happen again. Okay. All right. So, if there's no more questions, I will take a motion.
I have a comment. I haven't made a comment yet. I just want to say I think it's laughable that ULCT would be labeled as liberal when it's populated by elected officials from very conservative states or cities all across the state of Utah. So I just wanted to repeat what my good friend Keith Irwin says when these kinds of accusations are made. When you're standing at the South Pole, everything is north.
Okay. I'll take a motion.
I move that we disapprove of the resolution discontinuing membership in the Utah League of Cities and Towns.
Okay. I have a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Mr. Geddes seconds. Any further discussion? Let's have a vote. Mr. Crowley. This is to disapprove the motion.
Nay.
Okay. Mr. Zappala.
Aye.
Mr. Bailey.
Aye.
Mr. Geddes.
Aye.
Mrs. Reese.
Aye.
Mr. Crowley. The ayes have it, 4-1, and they prevail. Moving on now to our last ordinance, which is an action item on ordinance amending Title IX of the City Code relating to the performance of guarantees. Mr. Goodwin.
Do we skip one?
Yeah, you skipped 16.
16.
Sorry, you're right. 16, resolution related to resident, city staff, and elected officials' use of the golf course. And so this is something Mr. Crowley wanted to put on the agenda as well. I understand where he's coming from. Let's have a presentation by Mr. Goodwin.
Yeah, currently there's actually two resolutions as part of this memo. If you don't mind, can we just break up the discussion into two and just go over the first one initially?
Right ahead.
So the first one is regarding elected official use of the golf course. You saw we sent out the usage charts for staff and elected official use of the golf course last year for comp rounds. And you saw that those numbers are very underwhelming. It doesn't get used nearly as much as it could. So this would prohibit elected officials from receiving free golf as part of the benefits of serving. That's all.
Any questions on that? It's pretty straightforward, pretty simple. I think item two is going to come back and provide a good alternative, which I think was great of Mr. Crowley to come up with. So we handing it?
Can we have a discussion on this?
We certainly can. I'm trying to see if we're going to be doing this as two motions.
It is two motions, yeah.
Two motions, okay. Yes. So let's have a motion. We'll have a discussion as well. So okay. Someone like to make a motion on this?
I'd like to make a...
That we approve a resolution 5-2-2017. Is it D?
It'll be E.
E. Unelected officials' use of Cedar Hills Golf Club.
Okay. I have a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Motion's been seconded. Now we'll have some discussion.
Okay. Personally, obviously, when I was or ran for city council, this was one of my hot buttons. I mean, I'm biased. I love the golf course. I'm a golfer. I didn't run for city council to get free golf. In fact, I've been a season pass holder since the golf course opened. And personally, I've already talked to Rob today about this. I'm not personally offended by this because this is sort of directed at me. I'm the only one that golfs on the council or the mayor. But I'm proud of the fact that I know about our golf course. I golf it. I know what holes need work on, where things can be corrected. And I love to take my friends and neighbors to the golf course. And they're paying people that come and play. So I don't know what I've added as far as revenue to the golf course, but it's significant with just the people that I share our beautiful golf course with. And so when I found out I was going to buy a season pass the year I was elected to the city council, and I was informed by the city manager that elected officials don't have to pay for golf. So naturally I didn't. And so, I mean, I'm proud of that. I think that's a great benefit for elected officials and also our employees. I wish our employees would use it more because it's a great way to get out and enjoy nature and, you know, get a little exercise. I wish more of the city council would use it so that you know what's going on, because we spend a fair amount of money on it. And by going out, you're aware of what's going on the golf course. You can go to the driving range and see what goes over the nets. And so I am not offended by this. I mean, I'm happy to pay for my golf, but I don't think that's the issue. This isn't a money issue. I really wish the city council would use this benefit, because honestly, this is not a fiscal issue. Whether or not the golf course has me on it, or Councilman Crawley, or Councilman Bailey, or Councilwoman Reese, it doesn't matter. There's no loss of revenue. The golf course is there. It's got fixed cost, and there's really no cost to it. So I would recommend that we continue the policy, and I would encourage the council members and our employees to get their friends and neighbors out on the golf course. I was really disappointed to find out that we send around a coupon every year for residents to have their free round of golf, and it includes a cart. It's a $38 value, I think. $40 value now. And I checked just the other day with Wade, and I'm astounded by how few people use that. I don't know. It was certainly less than 30, I believe, this year already, right? May I ask Greg? So my only point is, this isn't a fiscal thing. I think as employees of the city, which we are, and managers of the city, I don't think this is a perk that's outside of the realm of what any other normal business or whatever. I don't think we're highly paid, you know, in our positions here. I think it's something that should be used by us. We should get out. We should invite our friends. And I think the position should stay the way it is.
So I want to say a couple of things. One is that there has been a policy in place, but Mr. Crawley just wanted to formalize it with a resolution. And so the policy, as long as I've been elected official, is that elected officials only get free golf if they're bringing paying golfers with them. But it was more of a recommendation as opposed to what Mr. Crawley's trying to do is formalize it. And so I wish this isn't a problem for our city right now, because no one's really golfing and that much. And so I know Mr. Geddes golfs, but I wish you, like Mr. Geddes says, I wish you were bringing golfers with you every single week in golfing. That would be a problem I'd like to solve. Right now, I don't have that problem to solve because it doesn't exist. But before we vote on this, then I think we should bring up what Mr. Crawley's solution was, and I agreed with this, which is that he has suggested to allow a free golf game for residents, employees, and elected officials when they bring a minimum of two additional customers paying full price for green fees. So my opinion, I'd maybe move that to three paying customers, but as a business person, that makes sense, guys. Is if you're a regular golfer, and I would actually prefer the language to specify, you know, maybe a twice a month golfer or something like that. But it's up to you in terms of the language. But as a business person, this makes sense. If you were to have a policy that said for regular golfers, because you don't golf by yourself usually, you're golfing in threesomes, foursomes, and so if you're bringing paying golfers with you every single time, that's a good business decision. So I just would like you to think about the language that you use on item number two, and I think that would make sense. But in order to move to item two, there has to be an affirmative vote on item number one, otherwise it doesn't really make sense. So any questions for Mr. Goodwin on this? Mr. Godwin.
Can I say a few things about this one? I've discussed this with staff, and golfers go out in pairs of four, so we would ask that this be changed to three people rather than one, so you're going out with a full group rather than leaving a
capacity. Three people instead of two, right?
Well, it'd be the individual plus three full-paying individuals. So they'd be going out as a foursome, so they'd be going out as a full group. The other thing is clarify that it's full paying. It's not one person has a Groupon and one person has some other voucher. It's three full paying customers.
It says paying full price.
Okay. I just want to clarify that on the record that's what it means. And last, I have some hesitancies of it. I see the business idea behind it. I do have some hesitancies fully accepting it, and so we would ask that it maybe be a 6-month trial, that we come back and report to the council on its utilization and say this is something that we don't recommend continuing, this is something we do recommend continuing, just giving it an evaluation period.
I think that makes sense, because it's possible people could try and game the system, and thereby that could really hurt revenues.
Well, and it doesn't even require gaming the system. Okay. It could simply be that there are already people who are residents who are coming to golf with three people, and now we're giving it to them free, and so revenues actually go down.
That's what I'm saying.
There's many unintended consequences. Right? So if we're going to pass this one, I would strongly say 2 or 3 months or something like that. Like, we make it a special, like maybe in July or August or some other month. Maybe it's even a less busy month, like May or June.
Well, if it's May and June, I mean, you saw the projections for revenues this year. We're already a little bit behind. We're hoping that May and June catches us back up to budgeted amounts for. It's really hard to determine what the fiscal impact of this will be, because there are individuals that come here with groups that they're regular golfers. And you're right. What they might just rotate who doesn't pay that month or that day. There's ways to – these are concerns.
Yeah, but a lot of our residents will go to other golf courses, and if they're getting that incentive, they might say, hey –
it's possible.
So I guess the question –
it's not clear what the impact will be.
Does it draw more people in than abuse it? Is it a financial boom?
Do you think we'd be able to tell that? Will we be able to tell whether it helps or hinders our revenue?
Could.
You can tell.
We just have to try. It'd be tough. It'd be a lot of work. And I agree. I think you do it during a softer month because you're going up against some big.
So maybe 3 months, you know, for what, yeah, what months would you suggest?
I would actually say the months that we're in right now.
Maybe through the end of the fiscal year.
I think that's a good idea.
What do you guys think?
Well, I think, I mean, it's really more of a philosophical issue for me. I don't think it's going to have much fiscal impact one way or the other.
I don't either.
It could be negative or it could be positive. It's more a philosophical question of, since residents are already paying for the course a significant amount, do we want to give them a benefit? And we've already given them a benefit of a free round per year.
We give them a free round, and I'm afraid that isn't there also a birthday round as well?
So, I mean, I guess the other thing I would maybe add in, if it's going to just simply be a trial period, that's fine with me. If we're going to make it permanent, then I would say I would limit it to a certain number of times per year. You know, if residents are paying on average, I believe it's around $9 a month for the golf course debt for a typical household. That doesn't add up to a whole lot of rounds of golf. I don't know, it adds up to more than one. It might add up to maybe two. I'm just not convinced this is going to make a big deal.
Can I add to your philosophical argument? As a non-golfer, I actually don't have a strong opinion on this either way, because I agree. I don't think it's going to impact revenues either way. My only concern is I feel like there's already this sort of perception that golf is mainly played by a certain demographic. And we have all these other recreation programs where we do not offer this benefit. We don't tell mom down the street, if you enroll three of your children in junior jazz, you get one entry for free. And so I hate giving into this perception that here we are again giving some kind of a benefit to golfers that we don't give to any other recreation program in our city. So that's just a concern that I would question, that might cause some contention for people who say, I'm not ever going to golf, but I have my kid enrolled in soccer and basketball, and how come I can't get something free?
I have to come back to both of your points, and that is that this really is a business, though, and it's a business with high fixed costs. And for someone to come to limit how many times someone can bring paying golfers to the golf course seems counterproductive when most costs are fixed. There is very little additional cost to coming several times. And if you're bringing two or three people every time, then you're increasing the revenue to the city. So that was to the argument about
not necessarily
the number of times. And then, since it is a business, we need to treat it a little bit differently than other recreation opportunities, because there is very little additional cost when you bring a paying customer to golf. So encouraging people to bring paying customers, I think, is a great thing. But anyway, that's another perspective on that.
Any other discussions?
I personally don't think it's going to encourage people to golf more, because people who don't golf, I myself am one of them. I think it's beautiful. I love to walk around it, and I'm glad it's there because it's pretty. But I'm not, even if I had a benefit as an elected official to get free round of golf, it's not something I'm going to take advantage of because I'm not a golfer.
Okay. I just have one other question, which is more toward Mike, since this is a little bit targeted towards him, the first one. What's your preference? Would you like to see us approve the second one and just make this benefit available to everybody, or do you like the status quo of where we're at? You're the one who uses the golf course the most.
Personally, I'd like to. I kind of agree with Jenny on this one, that it's. I don't think there's going to be a revenue enhancer or anything to the city, and I'd like to just leave everything status quo, if you ask me.
No, and I would say what's good for the goose is good for the gander. If it brings revenue to the city for a city council member to bring people to golf, and he can golf for free or she, then you can say the same for the residents who actually own the course too. So I think we should make it be the same for, you know, I think making it the same for residents and city council members is important.
Yeah. So for whatever it's worth, I would recommend that we put this policy in place for a trial period, see how it works. Maybe it'll surprise you. Maybe it's going to increase revenue that you hadn't anticipated, because people are excited about doing it this way. And so at the same time, while we're talking about golf, Cheryl presented other golf courses have other ways of attracting golfers, seniors, military, youth, women. We ought to have the director of golf look at all of those things and see if there's ways to increase revenue at the golf course. And so we can take that up as a separate issue, but I would definitely want our golf department to be looking at those things.
I agree with that. I think that's a really good suggestion. I also would like to see some consideration to not necessarily prioritizing new revenue, but new participants that are residents. I'd like to see, especially youth, encouraged to get out and use the course.
Well, we do have I think there's some youth camps and things coming
up. Greg, just let me know that there is a youth rate already. Yeah.
That's fantastic.
And so,
but whatever we can do to get more people using the course from Cedar Hills,
exactly.
That's a benefit because now there's more buy-in to the fact that, hey, we have this and we actually do use it.
So just to piggyback on yours and the mayor's point on that is that, I mean, I tend to agree that I think it's good to get feedback. My only thing is I wish this had come from our recreation department and our golf director as opposed from our council member who has, you know, he loves golf, but he has a bias about our golf course. And I would like to have seen it come from staff as opposed to come from our council. So
wouldn't it be a great unifying theme? Something we all push for, and it gets a little publicity to say, hey, there's a new program, and it gives a little attention to the golf. Wouldn't that be a good thing?
So I'm in favor of the second one as a trial period for the next couple months. I'm not in favor of the first one.
Okay,
and I'm not in favor of the second one.
We need to have a vote. So let's start.
So we need a motion.
Let's start with the first one.
There's a motion first.
And someone's going to have to make a motion.
There's a motion on there on the first one. And there's a second.
Okay. Motion. Oh yeah, that's right. We're in the discussion phase right now. So I have a motion that's been seconded by Mrs. Reese. We've had some discussion. So let's have a vote on item number one. So, Mr. Crowley,
hold on. It's a little discussion.
What's the motion again? Because the motion is second and third.
It's just
just as it's written.
Just, the elected
just as
officials.
It's written, number one here. Whereas elected officials have a responsibility to vote. It's number one.
And are we doing it temporary or?
No. This is just. This is the one that's basically
saying that elected officials may not be given preferential treatment over residents. That's the resolution we're voting on.
Okay. And I hate to drag this out, but I'd kind of like to hear what the other proposals are, because that's going to impact my vote, is knowing what some other proposals are going
to
be.
I would like to make a motion for the second one, that we run it as it's stated, but with a period of May and June.
Can I propose one additional amendment? Strike out employees.
Sure.
For this one right here?
For the second one.
I support that. We
have a number of employees that do use the golf course minimally, and it is a fringe benefit that they are taxed on. If they're a golf employee, they're not taxed on it. The IRS doesn't require us to tax that fringe benefit.
So you'd rather keep employees as is?
Keep employees as is. A lot of our employees are volunteers, and the reason they're volunteering is because they get free golf.
And just so you all know, Chandler and I talked about that. I don't know why I didn't get in here.
I need to email that to you. I got that the other day. I apologize for
that. But that was part of my original suggestion, that we don't change for employees. Right.
This just affects elected officials.
Yes. The first one.
The first one.
And the second one.
We'll talk about the second when we get there, but I think talking about making it a two-month period, mm-hmm. striking employees. I actually would strike elected officials as well, just residents, because all elected officials are residents.
So
that's true.
So how about we just table it for today? Let Chandler and staff come up with how it should, what we've discussed, and then we bring it back in 2 weeks so that it's...
Well, the first one, I think...
Because we want to do a trial period for May and June, so...
And we've got a motion on the table, and I don't think we're suggesting changes.
So we do have a vote that we need to take, and this is and this affects elected officials only. So I'm starting with Mr. Crowley.
Aye.
Nay.
Mr. Zappala is a nay. Mr. Bailey.
Nay.
Nay. Mr. Geddes.
Nay.
Mrs. Reese.
Nay.
Okay.
So the nays have the next proposal.
And the free golf stays with elected officials.
Okay, now we're on resolution number F?
Yes.
Okay.
That didn't pass.
No.
It didn't pass.
Do we number only ones that pass?
So you're still E.
We're still E.
This is so confusing. Mm-hmm. I thought we advanced the number when I had the other one that didn't pass earlier, but okay.
Well, there was a positive resolution.
So I move that we approve resolution number 5-2-2017E, a resolution of the City Council of the City of Cedar Hills, Utah, regulating residents' free golf allowance, with changes that we do this for a trial period of May and June of this year, 2017, and also striking any language referring to employees and elected officials.
Okay.
I'll, I will second that.
I have a motion. It's been seconded. Any further discussion?
Can we emphasize poll paying?
What?
Can we emphasize poll paying?
Oh, yes.
Is that this it does not include coupons.
And was it two
rates?
Or three additional customers?
I think it should be.
Oh, yes. The motion I would like two. To amend my motion that it specify that you bring three additional customers and emphasize that they are paying full price for green fees.
Okay. And I'll re-second that.
All right. So a motion. It's been seconded. I think everyone understands it. I'm going to start with Mrs. Reese.
This doesn't answer. Can we have a little discussion first?
Can we have a what?
Can discussion. We have one little quick discussion?
Yeah, sure.
The way this reads is the city council resolves that all residents, employees, and elected officials are allowed a free golf game when bringing with them a minimum of two additional customers during full price for green fees. Right. This kind of implies that the employees or the city council members have to bring paying customers anyway. It kind of accomplishes the first thing.
Except for that he struck the term.
So the new wording is that all residents are allowed a free golf game when bringing with them a minimum of three additional customers paying full price in bold for green fees.
Yeah.
It's for 3 months, you said?
Two months.
2 months, May and June.
Yeah. Well, I think that most of the council members would take paying customers when they go anyway, so I don't know. I think it's good. But.
All right. Okay. All right. So I have a motion that has been seconded. And we're ready for a vote. So Mrs. Reese.
Aye.
Mr. Geddes.
Aye.
Mr. Bailey.
Aye.
Mr. Zappala.
Aye.
Mr. Crowley.
Aye.
Motion was unanimous. Thank you very much. Moving on now to item number 17, which is an action item on an ordinance amending Title IX of the City Code relating to performance guarantees. Mr. Goodwin.
Just as a note, I'm looking at the motion on this one as well, and it should say ordinance. It does not. I apologize. This is what happens when we try to rush the packet out. This is another instance where we're finding deficiencies in our code, and we're trying to bring them up to state code. In 2015, legislation was passed that affects a city's ability to collect or hold durability bonds or surety bonds. Currently, our city code reads that the surety bond, when a contractor does a development, we hold a bond in the amount of the estimated public improvements. And when they're done and those improvements are accepted by the city council, they go into what's called the durability phase, where we watch those improvements for the course of 2 years and ensure that those improvements that they've made and dedicated to the city council or dedicated to the city hold up. So if there's road fractures, sidewalks cracking, or curb gutter failure, that before that portion of the bond is released, they replace those in that durability period. The durability period in our code is 2 years, and it's 20% of the original construction bond. State legislation has passed that restricts that term to 1 year and 10% of the original construction bond, or an exact estimate if that is available. So this is an update to be in compliance with state code. Other questions?
Any questions from the council?
Yeah, only thing I need to state on this is I need to recuse myself on this. I have two durability bonds currently in place, but I support the legislation.
So are you recusing yourself? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay. All right. So any other questions? Let's have a motion.
Okay, so this is ordinance...
C.
I move that we approve ordinance number 5-2-2017. Oh, wait, I already forgot. C. To approve the changes to the Cedar Hill City Code Title IX related to performance guarantees.
I have a motion. Is there a second?
I'll second.
Mr. Crowley seconds it. Any further discussion? Let's have a vote. Mrs. Reese.
Aye.
Mr. Bailey.
Aye.
Mr. Zappala.
Aye.
Mr. Crowley.
Aye.
Motion was unanimous. Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, that is it for the evening. I will take
Can I bring something up first?
Go for it. You can bring up a discussion.
Yes. But I'd like to bring up a discussion.
What would that be?
I'm planning on moving pretty soon. I mean, not extremely soon, but...
Do you mean before the end of the year?
Before the end of the year.
Then you're going to have to resign, and there will be a special election.
Okay.
An appointment.
I'm wondering if we see. I don't know exactly where I'm going to move, but I'm wondering if we could. Is there any way to work on a special election while I'm in office and then have it happen?
I thought we do appointments. We don't do appointments. We do an appointment.
Hold on, everyone.
Yeah.
And so there is a procedure, mm-hmm. and so a special election cannot start until you've actually resigned.
Okay.
So, if I would suggest if you're moving soon, then give your notice sooner than later.
Well, I mean, I don't know exactly the day I'm going to move or how soon it's going to be, but it's probably going to be sometime soon after the beginning of June or mid-June, somewhere in there.
Okay, so let me make this easy.
Okay.
Will you give me notice of your resignation tonight?
No.
Okay, how soon will you do that so that we can post?
I actually would prefer to stay on the city council as long as possible. I'm disappointed to leave. I've enjoyed my time here. So
how soon are you going to be moving?
Probably mid-June, I'm guessing.
Okay, so what I would recommend, and no one can force you to step down.
Right.
So what I would recommend is it would be best if the city council did not have a time period where there's not a fifth voting council member.
That's right.
And having gone through special election for my seat and then the special election that Daniel took, these things take some time. And if you're moving in June, that really doesn't give us much time. So I would recommend, Mr. Crawley, that perhaps in the next week or so, you submit your notice of resignation so that we can start the process of creating a special election.
Gary, his seat is up this year. There's no special election needed.
It's well, it would create a vacancy, and if they appointed it, it would fill the remainder of his term, which would be through the end of the year.
That's right.
But that's not an election. That's an appointment.
No, it's an appointment.
It's a special election is what it's called.
It's just an appointment.
It's just like
it's an appointment.
Well, let's have our attorney.
You're appointed, but the process is called a special election. So
I will let Mr. Shaw.
Yeah. What the state law describes is that there should be an appointment of someone to fill the seat.
Right.
And that person then has the option to stand for election at the soonest opportunity. And so they would actually run for election at the end of the year. So they would fill the seat for just a few months. And then should they so choose, they could run for the election. Otherwise, it would be an open seat.
Although, you and I have talked a little bit about this, I called Mr. Shaw. If it happened after the filing deadline, if I resigned after the filing deadline of June, was it June 9th or 10th? Then the code was really. What is it?
1 through 7.
1 through 7. The code was very unclear about how to handle that situation,
yeah.
Or if there was even a appointment at that point. And I'd prefer that we work on an appointment while I'm a council member, and then.
But we can't do that. We can't appoint someone to the council when you're on the council still.
Right.
There has to be an opening.
You're right. There has to be an opening. And so the resignation needs to happen first, and then there needs to be an appointment. Now, if Mr. Crawley wants input into that, I'm sure he can work with many of you toward that purpose. So, of course, you wouldn't have a vote in the appointment. So, and I'll take a closer look at it because we are so close to the election deadlines. Normally, the special election, as the mayor refers to, would occur in a non-election year.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a bit of an anomaly.
Yeah, and if we ended up having an appointment because it was after the deadline, I would rather we have an election. I think it's better to have an election of an elected official than an appointment.
Yeah.
I would rather the appointment was only to close out the end of the year, not for a whole year and a half.
So I'll talk to Mr. Shaw a little bit about what my options are.
So just one comment on this that I'd have for Rob. You know, I know that one thing that you've always pushed for was if you don't have a vested interest or such as the golf vote, you know, we shouldn't be voting, or we shouldn't get free golf if we have a vested interest. And I just invite you to look at what the mayor and some others have said, that now that you're moving, you may not have a vested interest in Cedar Hills anymore. And so to drag that on, some of your votes may and I don't know. I'm not in your head or whatnot.
A little bit about that.
But I
care about Cedar Hills.
But if you're not a resident here anymore, there again, along those same principles, maybe, you know, if we can get this process moving so that we can get someone in here that's going to be a resident, not just, you know.
So you're saying resign quicker rather than later is what you're trying to say nicely.
Well, and that's up to you, but there again, if you're not going to be a long-term, but you're going to make long-term decisions for the city, but you're, I guess what I'm saying is you may be making long-term decisions and short-term decisions for the city of a city that you're not going to be living in.
True.
And so if that was anywhere else, I'm guessing that you or some of the other residents that are, you know, very ultra conservative would just be all over that and saying, hey, you're not even going to be living here. Why are you even? I'm just throwing that out. I'm not saying that you would do that because I think you're an honorable person. But on the spirit of the emails and all that other that I've read, you know, over the last 2 years, you know, I'm guessing you would, you know, if I was leaving, your advice would be the same to me. Hey, Ben, you're leaving. You probably don't really have a deep-rooted...
Actually, I've talked to a few, and they would like my conservative voice as long as they could possibly get it on the council. Well,
and I get that. I get that. But personally, you know...
Mayor, if I could close it out on one thing that clearly is not ambiguous in the state code, and that is with respect to residency. Residency is no longer having a permanent domicile with no intent to return. And that's not to mean that you're not welcome here at our meetings and so on and so forth, but that you wouldn't be here as a permanent citizen of Cedar Hills. So the residency definition is quite clear.
Okay. So you know what to do, Mr. Crawley. I think you got a little time to figure this out, but please don't take too much time.
Okay.
All right.
Thanks.
I'll take a motion to adjourn.
I move that we adjourn.
I have a motion. Is there a second?
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion was unanimous. Thank you very much.